Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Safety Insurance, offering a variety of home insurance products to cover your home's increased value. You can ask an independent agent about Safety Insurance. Safety Insurance will help you manage life's storms. And The Lyric Stage, presenting The Drowsy Chaperone. This bubbly love letter to musical theater includes mix-ups, mayhem, and a wedding or two. Now through May 12th at Lyric Stage Boston. Tickets at lyricstage.com.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, today it's the State Department's Inspector General. Tomorrow, the special envoy to Ukraine. Is the impeachment inquiry about to break wide open? Then Sue O'Connell joins us, and she'll speak to this. If Hunter Biden is fair game, are the Trump kids as well?
The Mueller report warned us that Saudi Arabia and Russia will try to interfere in the 2020 election. Coming up, we'll hear from national security expert Juliette Kayyem about what the president's attempts to cover up phone calls with those countries means for our election security. All that is coming on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Brady, I am Marjorie Egan. I apologize for my voice. Jim infected me with a berry bag cold. You're listening to Boston Public
Excuse
Radio.
Excuse me.
89. I was just a little small in the studio, and you were sneezing nonstop all day long. Anyway, you're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
And I am Jim Browdy, and I am, no.
Uh-huh.
So first, Donald Trump tried to bury his call with the president of Ukraine, where he pressured him to dig up dirt on Joe Biden and his son. Then we found out that he's also tried to hide transcripts of his calls with Putin of Russia and Mohammed bin Salman of Saudi Arabia. Now the State Department Inspector General, an independent character, is calling for an urgent briefing on Capitol Hill about the Ukraine documents. That's happening today. Tomorrow, the special envoy, the former special envoy, who resigned, some think, so he could testify freely to Congress, it will be testifying on Capitol Hill as well. We're opening up the lines and asking you, is the impeachment inquiry picking up steam? There are a million things going on. We'll try to detail a lot of them. Or are the Democrats walking in a political trap? Our number is 877-301-897. We should obviously also mention, because it's a big deal, as was mentioned on the national news a couple of minutes ago, Bernie Sanders, 78 years old, has been hospitalized. He was experiencing some chest discomfort. My apologies if this is all repetitive. I wasn't listening closely to the NPR news. And they found blockage in one artery, and he's had two stents inserted, and they hope he'll be up and running again in a couple of days. I'm not a doctor. I know a little bit about this. I've read about these kinds of things and whole variety of other deals. This is not, it doesn't have to be a campaign ending thing.
It does not.
However, I think when you're 78 years old and you have this kind of procedure and you want to be president of the United States for 4 years or 8 years and you'd be 79 next November, it may have some impact, both on the candidacy of Elizabeth Warren, who is sharing the progressive vote, and on the candidacy of another older candidate, and that is Joe Biden.
Who's had aneurysms.
Oh, that's a very, very good point. And by the way, speaking of this, if nothing is developed, every minute there is another thing going on. As we speak, Nancy Pelosi and Adam Schiff, chair of the House Intelligence Committee, are holding a press conference. Our coworkers are monitoring that, and anything that is newsworthy, we will share with you the second learn about it.
Front page of the Globe today, story about Adam Schiff and his Framingham roots.
Yep.
I did not know he was a Framingham kid until just this week, and it talks about his time at Harvard Law School as well.
Mm-hmm.
But getting back to the Trump impeachment situation, this does not really have to do with the impeachment, but it's pretty startling that a new book by two New York Times reporters details what Trump wanted to do on the border, according to sources in his White House, that he suggested shooting migrants in the legs when they were trying to cross the border as a way to stop them from coming to the United States, that he suggested building a moat around the border instead of a wall. And he was so serious about it that the aides actually went out and priced how much a moat would cost to put around the border. And he at one point even suggested filling that moat with snakes or alligators, which is, you know, a little bit bizarre.
So what do his supporters, the only thing I guess they can say, I hope, is fake news, right? I mean, they can't say it's okay to be talking about shooting
migrants
in the leg.
You remember earlier this spring or summer, we had reports about how the president said that if people trying to get here threw rocks at the border agents, that the border agents would be entitled to shoot them and kill them.
He said that to the border agents when he was on the border.
Yes, he said that. I mean, that's not disputed. And then he was told you can't shoot people to kill them. And apparently that his follow-up was, how about we shoot them to incapacitate them?
But it's anybody, I'm serious. I don't care how anti-immigrant you are as a Trump supporter in Congress, you can't defend this. I assume what you say is
it's not true,
right?
Right.
Like anything they can't defend. In any case, you said it has nothing to do with impeachment. I would argue a president of the United States, if he did in fact say that you should shoot migrants in the leg to incapacitate them and then put a moat with crocodiles and snakes in it, I would argue that's problematic.
Well, it kind of goes to the fitness to lead that is not technically, I suppose, a part of the impeachment argument, but it is sort of an over. I mean, there's a lot of things that people question about the president, from his denial of the climate change emergency to his being accused by 20-some women, I think now at this point, of sexual misconduct, including one very credible rape allegation. It's all the things that the president has done. But this would be one of these peripheral things, I guess, that goes to his fitness to serve. But the most exciting thing today, and we have no idea what the Inspector General is going to say from the State Department. But we did have a development this morning when Secretary Pompeo of the State Department, who yesterday said that the diplomats could not, he was not going to allow them to testify. Apparently, he's turned around on that, that there will be some diplomats testifying. And more significantly, I think he has admitted that he now did, in fact, listen in to the phone call that was between the president of the United States and the president of Ukraine. And as I think most of us know by now, if you've been watching the news, he didn't outright lie about that before, but he danced around the question, being interviewed by Martha Raddatz, ex of WCVB News in Boston, when she said, what did he know about these conversations? When she asked, what did he know about these conversations? And he just went into how he hadn't seen the printout of the whistleblower's complaint. So
that's pretty close to a lie.
He was not, let's put it this way, truthful.
Now, there's one good thing that's happened in the last 24 or 36 hours, even though this guy is not a pro-impeachment guy. I believe he's the most senior member of the Senate, Chuck Grassley, a Republican from Iowa, who is a huge believer in whistleblowers. To his credit, said, I believe this is a quote, a whistleblower ought to be heard and protected. Now, that shouldn't have to be celebrated because that's the law. But in light of what the president of the United States is saying about the whistleblower, including that he or she has possibly committed treason, I think the fact that Grassley is standing up to the president actually in this environment matters. Again, we'll bring you up to speed if we hear anything about throughout the show, the content of what the Inspector General from the State Department is telling Congress. What is the urgent matter? We'll obviously bring you up to speed on Pelosi and Schiff, who are speaking as we speak. But let's get to your calls. 877-301-8970. Is this not a story? Every 10 minutes, there's another element. Every 10 minutes, something changes.
What's really distressing, and part of it is that this is what we do for a living, but it's not just me. I mean, I've talked to my friends about this, my children about this. It's just obsessing the country. It's kind of, I mean, those
of you
who
obsess the country.
Old enough to remember, I remember being as a kid being obsessed with the Watergate hearings back in the summer of, was it 72 or 73? I've forgotten now. Anyway, watching those hearings, and it was the summertime. I mean, being like a total little nerd out watching those hearings in the middle of the summertime.
I can't believe you're putting this the way you're putting this. That and this was about the most serious thing that can happen in the American government, the possible impeachment of the president of the United States.
They're a big deal. They're a big deal things, but it's kind of, you can't get away from it now. It's just like the line I've used a million times, but why not use it one more time, Marjorie?
Sure.
That normally, you know, we go on for days and sometimes weeks without ever thinking about the president of the United States. And ever since Donald Trump has been elected, I think whether you like him or don't like him, he's been kind of embedded in your brain. And now it's like you have nightmares or dreams about him. I mean, it's unbelievable. You can't get away from this guy.
877-301-8970. John from Gardner, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hey, John.
Hey, good morning, kids. Thanks.
Hi.
Hey, Madri, I golfed early, and I got to ask you, am I the only one ODing on the coverage of all this every night?
Well, I was just saying that. I'm like an addict, you know. I'm my phone every 2 seconds, and I'm a shadow of my former self, John.
Oh, you and me both. You know, as I think you guys recall, I'm pretty cautious. I've been cautious about the impeachment because my main priority, like a lot of us, is getting rid of this guy one way or the other, if not sooner than in the election. But to your early question, Jim, I think it is gathering steam, and it is hard to really criticize the path the Democrats are going down because it's just so much in your face. And it is, as you say, it's fascinating thinking about what this Inspector General's emergency meeting is about. But, and you guys already said it, every 10 minutes, Jim and Marjorie, it's like unbelievable. And I watched that interview last night, Marjorie, with those two authors.
Oh, yeah, about the snakes and the alligators.
Two New York Times authors, yeah.
And you're saying to yourself, the President of the United States and his own people, they don't know whether to take him serious or not, but they placate him by, you know, drawing up the – it's unbelievable.
Well, you know, there was a really good piece in the Washington Post talking about the presidency of one, and it was talking about Trump's really remarkable ability to co-opt vast sections of the United States mm-hmm. government. Like when he came in, remember we were all talking about how he's going to become presidential and he was going to have these groups around him, the adults around him, McMaster, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It talked about how he has managed quite brilliantly to get rid of everybody who doesn't agree with his world perspective. And he has gotten people like Pompeo, who I think was well respected in Republican circles and Barr, to buy into these bizarre conspiracy theories.
Well, except you told me yesterday, Barr is a conspiracy theorist long before Donald Trump, which is one of the reasons he took the job at the end of his career.
I'm not sure which conspiracy theories he bought into. I'm not sure if he was, you know, we didn't land on the moon, or if he bought into the one that Hillary's server is somewhere over in Ukraine, which apparently is just one of these dark web kind of nutty conspiracy theories. But he's got these two men, Pompeo and the Attorney General, doing his bidding for him. It's really something.
John, thanks for the call. You know, also, we were talking about Michael Lewis, who just wrote a year ago wrote The Fifth Risk. And it sounds dull, but Lewis is not only a brilliant writer, but he's talking about the inner workings of a couple of cabinet departments and talking about taking over the departments. One of the things that was most stunning to me, which really wasn't the headline when I interviewed him, 6 months ago or something, was he went to whatever departments, I think one was Commerce, I'm not sure, whatever, two secretariats, and he looked at the briefing books that are left for the new staff that comes in under a new president, and he said in most of the cases, he was the first person who ever cracked open these books to take a look at them. They were not interested in the history and the protocols and whatever else is that applies to these people. You know, by the way, one of the things that I wasn't sure about this, but something I learned in the last 24 hours too, there was some dispute in light of the absolutely irresponsible behavior of Mitch McConnell when he refused to even hold a hearing for Merrick Garland. There was some view that even if the House were to impeach the President of the United States, that he would refuse to hold a trial. He acknowledges that he is mandated to hold a trial. But there's a however. The however, which I learned, is just like the Democrats moved to dismiss the articles of impeachment against Bill Clinton and failed because they weren't a majority. After the opening statements in an impeachment trial in the Senate, you are permitted to move to dismiss the charges. So if all the Republicans held strong with the Republican president, there'd be opening statements and the Republicans would move to dismiss the charges. And again, if they all stuck together, the charges would be dismissed in fairly rapid order. Who knows how the American people would react to that? 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Jim in New Hampshire. Hi, Jim.
Hello, Jim.
Hi, yeah. Say, I hope you feel better, Marjorie.
Thank you. I know I feel good. I just sound awful, but thank you.
I am outraged at the fact that I feel that there's a mole in the system, and I feel that this is 100% partisan, and I don't feel that Barr is just running around half-cocked out there trying to. I think that the guy's doing his job. I think that there's a lot of things that are going to come out in the wash. And I think that people just need to wait and see what happens because the people on Fox, they're not all, there's not a bunch of dummies on Fox either.
Well, you know, Jim, so your position is it's okay for the Attorney General of the United States to go to places like Italy and try to dig up information that would not only discredit the Mueller investigation, but discredit all of the intelligence agencies in the United States that did determine that the Russians had interfered in our election. That is his mission. That's okay with you?
I think that there's more to the story than, and I think that there's going to be some things that come out of Barr's investigation that are going to show that's going to back up how I
feel. Why didn't they come out in the 2 years of the Mueller investigation?
But, you know, with all due respect, that isn't what he's getting impeached about. The president is getting impeached because he admitted, Jim, and you can hear it. We played it yesterday. The president admitted with his own words, he said it, that he spoke to the leader of Ukraine, which is terribly dependent on the United States for military aid because they are fighting a war with Putin, who is an ally of the president, I think it's fair to say. The president admitted that he pressed the Ukraine leader to investigate his political rival. And that is something that I think the Democrats had to move on because, as you know, in our Constitution and our founders, this is a big deal. You can't have...
It's also a violation of law.
It's a violation of the law as well. So the president has said it himself, and you cannot do that. You cannot go to a foreign nation and ask them to undermine a United States election. That's the problem, Jim. You know what I mean?
Biden did.
What?
Biden did. Biden did.
No, he actually did not.
That's the spin. That's the spin you're getting from Fox News, where I would say, Jim, they do lie. What they're trying to tell you, they're trying to confuse people. There were two, what do they call them in Ukraine? Inspector generals? What are they called?
Prosecutors.
Prosecutors, excuse me. There were two prosecutors in Ukraine. The one Biden was trying to get rid of was the one that wasn't doing any prosecuting. And by the way, Biden and a bunch of other people from all around the world wanted to get rid of this prosecutor. He was doing nothing, including investigating the company where Biden's sons work. So what Biden did with other world leaders was press to get a new prosecutor in who would have been more aggressive. It's a fog. It's trying to confuse people about what really happened. And Biden's action, by the way, had nothing to do with interfering in an American election. But I think this is why the Republicans have such a difficulty. They don't want to answer this question because they're just trying to they're lying and they're trying to fool people.
Jim, thank you, though, for listening and calling. As always, we appreciate your call. 877-301-8970.
Let's go to Brunier in Hyde Park.
Good morning, Marjorie. I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
Your voice sounds like you got infected by Trumpitis.
Maybe I did, crying in front of my television set.
There are two things I'd like to say. One, I think people are wasting their time trying to explain or convince to the likes of Jim from New Hampshire or any Trump supporter using logic. Because I was talking to a friend of mine who was asking, how could intelligence people be supporting Trump? And I told her that the way to understand the Trump people, the Trumpists, think of it as a religion. You know, why are intelligent people getting involved with the cult? And that's the way it is. People who are involved with a cult, you can't use logic. They hear you, but they find a way to get out of the conversation and then keep repeating the same thing. That's the way I feel like these people are. I know very smart people and very good people. I have two friends in Boston who are very good. I'm talking about generous, wonderful people. They are big time Trump supporters. I just cannot understand it.
Well, you know,
it's like a religion.
Let me try to explain it. I was just looking for a poll while you were speaking, Brunier. Marjorie says every single day, you know, people have enough time to watch 15 minutes of the news or read 15 minutes of the newspaper, and I wish they did. Listen to this poll that was done by Monmouth. You and I haven't discussed this yet, Marjorie. In a poll of Republican respondents, 40% said that Trump probably raised the idea of an investigation into Biden when he was speaking with the president of Ukraine. 29% of Republicans said Trump probably did not mention an investigation. Now, again, as you have said, this is not one of these accusations. This is something that the president himself, in his own words, has acknowledged, and a huge swath of the party that supports him isn't even sure it happened, even though the president said it happened. It's not surprising that there is this partisan divide. Bernier, thanks as always.
What I think the president has been brilliant at, again, is saying what you hear and what you see is not what you hear and what you see.
Even when I tell you I did it.
Yeah. He's
29% said he probably did not mention an investigation into Biden.
And he did. He mentioned it himself.
It's there.
I know. But I think, again, and I have always put a lot of, it's not just Fox News. It's kind of a Trump industrial complex. It's Fox News, who has the leading viewership on cable, and they are in the tank for the president. I think there's no doubt about it. At night, not during the day, Chris Wallace did and he's a Fox News guy, did a brilliant interview with Stephen Miller and really
your
eviscerated.
Favorite guy, Stephen Miller.
Stephen Miller, yeah. Chris Wallace is a great reporter. Shep Smith is a great reporter, but the nighttime lineup has, you know, made their bed, as it were. But it's not just them. It's Rush Limbaugh. It's Mark Levin. It's his cohorts in, and Sean Hannity, who has a huge radio audience. So it's all these people telling you, trying to confuse you about prosecutors and buying into this fog. And this is very typical in authoritarian countries. It's not typical in the United States of America. But that is what Trump has managed to do, is create this fog machine, and people get swept up in it. And as Bernier said, too, there's a, you know, there's a cult thing here, and there's a get the libs. What's the word about getting the libs upset?
I don't know.
Annoying the liberals or playing the libs or whatever it is.
So before we take a break here, we promised you a little bit of an update from this joint press conference between the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, and the Intelligence Committee Chair, Adam Schiff, who's leading this whole thing. Here he is. This is Schiff speaking about Secretary Pompeo's efforts to prevent certain witnesses from testifying before Congress.
We want to make it abundantly clear that any effort by the secretary, by the president, or anyone else to interfere with the Congress's ability to call before it relevant witnesses will be considered as evidence of obstruction of the lawful functions of Congress. And more than that, will allow an adverse inference to be drawn as to the underlying facts.
And again, you know, this is an important point. It's kind of a nerdy point, but we do have three separate parts of the government in the United States of America. We have the executive branch, the legislative branch, and the judicial branch. And what the Trump White House is trying to do is thwart the independent powers of the legislative branch. So you can't stand by and watch the White House. I think this is where Nancy Pelosi had to do something. You can't stand by and watch them flout the laws over and over and over again. And remember that Bill Clinton and Richard Nixon were both impeached.
In part for obstruction
of
justice.
In part for obstruction of justice. And, of course, Bill Clinton also lied about sex, as we all know. No one in America has ever lied about sex except for Bill Clinton. We can all agree on that. We're going to keep talking about this for a few more minutes. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brody and Marjorie. And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about the latest developments in the impeachment inquiry against Donald Trump. Our number is 877-301-8970. We're getting email about what's the Inspector General saying. The State Department Inspector General said an urgent matter to bring to Congress's attention. The answer is we don't know. And as soon as we do, so will you.
Sally from Natick, thank you for calling.
Hey, Sally.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I was responding to something that Marjorie said a little while ago regarding Pompeo and sort of where why Barr is there, where this is coming from. You know, Trump is always being fed stuff. In my opinion, he's a stooge. But the person who is still left there, you know, Bannon is gone, Sessions is gone, but Steve Miller is still there. And Steve Miller is the guy behind the curtain. Steve Miller is the guy who has he's a brilliant guy. I think he's an evil guy, but he's a brilliant guy who has a whole lot of plans and has had a whole lot of plans the whole time. I think it was in the New York Times or else it was a New Yorker, but I think it was the Times just recently in an article saying that it was Miller who was saying to Trump, get rid of Kirstjen Nielsen because she keeps telling you to follow the rules. You got to get these people who are telling you to follow the regulations and the rules out of here.
I'm not saying he doesn't have wider authority, but immigration is his calling card, or anti-immigration at any cost is his calling card. And I don't know this for a fact, Marjorie. I don't know if you heard more from the authors of the book, the crocodiles and snakes in the moats and shooting migrants in the leg. I don't know if that was a initiated from Trump's head himself or if that was a Stephen Miller-inspired tactic.
I have not read the book, but they don't mention Stephen Miller in the story.
Days.
Yeah.
Sally, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. It's the first time anyone has ever called about Stephen Miller that you have not mentioned him spraying on hair for an interview about a month or so ago, which Marjorie is obsessed with.
Well, I think he needs some therapy. That's what I think about Stephen Miller.
A lot of us do, yes.
Bill from Chelmsford, thank you for calling.
Hey, Bill.
Good morning, Marjorie and Jim. I hope you feel better soon, Marjorie.
Thank you.
I'd like to take issue with something you said yesterday, Jim.
Sure.
You said that if this was a head of a corporation in the United States, he'd be long gone before now. And you know what? That's just not true.
Well,
there's so many examples. This is exactly, Wells Fargo is a perfect example of the head of the company and his instructions, you know, without being said. All his people down below knew they had to open up all these accounts.
That's right.
What happened when the people spoke up? They got fired.
I stand corrected.
You know,
it's a wonderful point,
Bill.
That's
a great point, Bill. Yeah, that Wells Fargo story.
Most authoritarian regimes have been accomplished through military means. But in the United States, that's almost impossible to do. So they've used the actual corporate design and put it into place. Look at most of your major American corporations. They run as authoritative regimes. They surround themselves with board of directors that agree with them. It's a perfect economics ploy on the part of Trump and his people. So I don't know what the answer is. The American people will speak next week. This impeachment thing is so engrossing. It's just I'm like Marjorie. I can't get off the TV, but I get so mad when one of these guys get on even CNN who they sound like they're just spewing. You know, I don't even know what they're spewing, but it's just all lies.
Well, there's a lot of lies.
Bill.
We had a caller. He hung up now. Was going to talk about Joe Biden being a crook. I wish he'd stayed on the line. And that's because Rudy Giuliani is, and other people have talked about that Joe Biden was involved in the biggest bribery scheme in history or whatever he said. I'm paraphrasing. Joe Biden, ironically, is one of the poorest people ever to run for president because he's basically worked in politics.
Since he was in his 20s. And was he 29?
I think so, when he was elected to the Senate. He's not poor. I shouldn't say poor, but he's not loaded. I mean, most of the people that run for office have tons and tons of money.
Also, who's working for a ton of foreign governments?
Right.
But
well,
Rudy Giuliani.
You know, his son, I think it's all fair to say, it looks really sleazy and creepy that his son, Hunter, was getting $50,000.
I agree.
From that company, and that was absolutely sleazy. On the other hand, you have, except for Tiffany Trump, who seems to be not involved in the family business, you have all three of the Trump children are profiting off the presidency of their father. So,
we're going to discuss that with Sue in a minute about whether or not those kids are fair game, if Hunter Biden is fair game, which I think he is.
Laura on the Cape, thank you for calling, Laura.
Hey, Laura.
Hi. So, Marjorie, one thing I got to tell you is apple cider vinegar for whatever's going on.
Oh, thank you. It's just a cold. I feel fine. I know I sound terrible. Yep. I hope I'm not annoying people.
No, you're not.
No. You'll get rid of it. But I think it's really important to stay on point, and I think especially with people that keep trying to change the subject and bring up things that have nothing to do with it. The point is, whether Joe Biden did something illegal or not, it doesn't matter. The president of the United States cannot ask a foreign government to get involved in our elections and give him dirt. That's just against the law, and it doesn't matter what Joe Biden did.
Well, first of all, I think, if I may, Laura, it does matter if he did something illegal, and he didn't. This has been scrutinized to death. And, you know, I know Juliet Kayyem is going to be here at noon, yelled at me the other day when I brought up Joe Biden. There are gradations of offenses in our lives. And talking about what Biden's kid, for example, and Marjorie and I both feel it's inappropriate for him to be doing $50,000 a month from this energy company doesn't mean we're suggesting there's an equivalency with what Donald Trump and all of his men have done. But continue. I'm sorry.
You and I don't think Biden's done anything wrong, but the point is that you can't say, well, he did something wrong, so I get to do something.
Of course.
And we have to really drive that point home to people who are saying, well, what about Biden? It doesn't matter about Biden. Forget about Biden. It matters that the president of the United States went to another country and asked for help to interfere in our election. That's what counts.
So, Laura, before you go away, since you sound fairly impassioned, what do you think of that poll I read a minute ago where 29% of Republicans think that Donald Trump, quote, probably did not bring up an investigation of Biden in a call when Trump himself admits that he brought up Biden in the call. Is that a little depressing or what?
Well, this is how crazy it is, because people keep changing the subject. And I think that's the problem. I think that when you actually get to the facts, the subject is completely changed to something else. And so people lose their way in that from listening to all these news outlets.
Laura, thanks for your call. We really appreciate your time. Thanks so
okay,
much.
Okay, we are moving on from this for a while. Up next, we're going to talk
We will keep you up to speed, though. I mean, a lot of stuff's going
we'll
to happen in the next 2.5
yeah.
hours.
We're going to talk to Juliette Kime about impeachment again at noontime. But in the meantime, we're going to talk to Sue O'Connell about a bunch of stuff, including a federal judge upholding affirmative action at Harvard University. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Here with us in Studio 3 to go over, I wasn't paying attention, so I'm probably going to get a demerit. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over the social norms and abnormalities of the day is media maven Sue O'Connell. Sue is co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News, in-depth political reporter for NECN, and she's the host of WGBH's Lunch Hour Live. Tomorrow, by the way, you can catch Sue in conversation with award-winning chef Ming Tsai at the BPL studio. That's the library studio, 12 to 1. Hello, Sue.
And then I'll be checking out a cashier at Whole Foods overnight.
You will?
Yeah, why not? Just what? Add it. Just add another job.
That's fine.
What the heck?
I think you get free at the hot bar, all you can eat, which is.
I know I'll be
I
seeing
take
more
that
of
job.
You.
Exactly.
Can I use your discount, Sue? Sure you can, Jim Browdy.
So, media mavens.
Hello. You know that would happen. That's why it's so funny.
Now I can't even think of anything else, so go ahead.
Tell us about this decision on Harvard University and affirmative action and discriminating against Asian Americans.
Well, as the parent of an Asian American who wants to go to Harvard, I don't know how I feel about it.
Yeah, it's too bad.
I don't know. Yeah. I mean, this is such a difficult case to sort of parse out. You know, I think in the end, what we learned from the judge was that there was some sort of bias applied to Asian American students who were trying to get into Harvard. They got lower ratings on the so-called personality score. They got lower ratings on their interviews. The judge in the case said it was unsure whether that was because of guidance counselor biases and the reference letters or just societal bias, but could not prove that any of the students involved in the case were discriminated against directly and didn't get in. So, you know, I'm not an expert on affirmative action. I know that there are many activists who are relieved that this case came out the way it is. And I know there are also many who say this sort of just codifies that it's okay to discriminate against some people. So I don't know what
But I want to finish that sentence because it's okay to discriminate against some people if it turns out there's a larger benefit of diversity.
Yep.
And the argument for those, including Alison Burroughs, who's the judge here, and obviously Harvard, I'm not speaking for them, but the gist of it is that diversity is worth something.
Yes.
And as well, she said in her decision, Burroughs, I don't know her, but that this is not a perfect admission system. I don't know if she used that word.
But she didn't want to dismantle
it. Imperfection is not the same as unconstitutionality.
Right. So it'd be great if now society took a look at ourselves and said, you know, why did so many Asian American students feel the need to bring this case? That why were they not doing well on, quote unquote, not doing well on the interview process? You know, I listened to a great podcast. I suddenly flew out of my mind which one it was. But talking to an Asian American student who got to see, he went to Harvard and he saw his packet and saw he got, he saw the letter of recommendation from the Harvard person that he interviewed with. And he went to ask him, who was white, a Caucasian, you know, why did you use the words tiger mom? Why did you say that I was a traditional, you know, that that maybe if I got away from my parents or something, I might be able to break out? And the Caucasian white professor who met with him and then gave this letter to Harvard was married to an Asian American woman. Right. And he said, I think his wife. No, he was just saying it's a conversation. I think I've absorbed that, you know, so it's a very complicated conversation that we're all having. But I think it's important to note that it's a bias I think the takeaway for me on this is that if you're interviewing people for any reason, you need to be aware that you might have some unconscious bias.
And well,
that
by the way, this is not the end of the story. There's no question this guy is going to appeal this. We're going to hear more.
You know, there was a great piece in the New York Times talking about Trinity College, and it was written from the perspective of a kid who was from a low-income background.
Didn't one of your kids go to
Trinity? She did go to Trinity College, and I was stunned. I mean, she's the youngest of my three kids. I was struck by the amount of ostentatious wealth at Trinity College, with the cars and the clothes and those parkas that you hate, you know, those $1,000 parkas that the kids wear.
Oh, what are they called? They're huge at BU. Yeah. What are those things called?
It was startling. And not every college is like this. But the point she was making about Trinity College and other so-called elite schools is that the biggest problem is not enough low-income kids.
Yeah, it's definitely the diversity of economy, and then supporting. I mean, like we read in the Globe with the valedictorian. You know, these kids that were valedictorians in the Boston public school system, and then many of them were not set up to succeed when they got to the colleges that they were going. All sorts of colleges.
Yeah.
So we need to, as a society, invest in supporting students who have different needs than we think. Just because you get a scholarship. I mean, I can't even imagine if I had gotten a scholarship and went to some faraway college. It would have been a disaster. I mean, I came from a background where I should have done better. I can't even imagine if, you know, my parents were immigrants or didn't speak English or parents weren't in the home or any of the challenges that kids experiencing economic diversity have to go through. So we need to support students better.
Canada Goose is the name of this coach that drives me out of my mind.
Free plug to a great program called Steps for Success in Brookline. And Brookline is an affluent town, but not as affluent as like Wellesley or Weston and stuff. And there's a lot of African-American kids in not only Brookline, but come in from Boston and in Metco. They have a program where they mentor these kids right through graduation from college, so that when the kid that grew up in the projects gets into a Harvard or a Boston College or whatever and thinks, oh, my God, where's my Canada Goose jacket? I can't go to the movies, never mind skiing on the weekends, that they have someone that they can call up and say, what do I do? How do I negotiate this?
Talked to us about this very same issue in education the other day based on his incredible research, Raj Chetty, talking about how it was housing, actually.
Housing.
In terms of housing decisions and people with subsidies moving to better neighborhoods, those who had some mentoring, they had a navigator, I think is the word he used, someone to help facilitate their knowledge of the system and what their options are, did far better and end up far better than those who have to try to deal with the whole system on their own. So,
yeah, the other thing here, too, in this case, which we've been examining with the Varsity Blues case, is just how much leg up the legacy kids get, the legacy students and the elite athletes. And how, you know, investing, if you have the money to invest in getting a pitching coach for your kid or getting a hockey coach for your private hockey coach for your kid, unfortunately, that's going to make a difference.
Or you'd be Jared Kushner, whose father gave a ton of dough, and lo and behold, he ended up at Harvard.
Yeah, and how, if you can pay full freight, you have an advantage because then they don't have to worry about giving you any money.
Right.
It's a real mess. But this is kind of an uplifting story.
Okay.
Mattel. They have given up on, we just don't have Barbie and Ken and Skipper anymore, right?
Yeah.
Now we have gender-inclusive dolls.
This is, I can vividly recall, being like in third grade, right, in like 1969, 1970, and I had a Barbie, right? I really wanted a G.I. Joe, right? And this is when G.I. Joe was the same size as Barbie. It's before they shrunk them down. So I really wanted a G.I. Joe, so I got a Barbie. And then I got a Christie, who was the African-American Barbie doll.
Oh, yeah.
Because I was just pushing the envelope back in the 60s. And then I decided if I got a Brad and a Ken doll, then I could use them to play with the G.I. Joe dolls.
Exactly.
Right? So this is all of the crazy machination things I had to do in order just to have gender parity in my doll set, right, which is crazy. So, this is exciting. I think it sets, even though we're celebrating all these gender reveal parties with all these pink and, blue fires that get started because of people setting up fireworks. And have you seen this?
Oh yeah, of course, oh, absolutely.
That it's exciting that we're finally getting some dolls that represent how humans really are.
You know what I'm amazed by in the story? I assumed in the second half of the story it was going to be, and a family's value group and whatever was burning the dolls. Or is the reaction as muted as it appears to be? And which is a wonderful.
Yeah,
statement
of
progress.
I think that as the gender norms relax just a little bit, I'm not going to pretend like they've totally relaxed. I think more and more kids, more and more parents are having children that are expressing themselves for who they are. And I'm not just saying trans kids. I'm just saying, you know, instead of pushing people into these, and it's mostly girls who are able to be more free to express other parts of their personalities than boys are. But I think that parents generally are open-minded.
Well, remember
to this.
Richard Blanco, who is our poet that comes with us once a month for Village Voice. He's a gay guy, an inaugural poet, only the fifth inaugural poet in American history. He's written a lot of poetry about being a little kid in a very macho culture down there in Florida. His parents came here from Cuba. And how, you know, his grandmother's always on his back when he wanted to paint his fingernails instead of playing with the G.I. Joe dolls. And you know, it must, if you realize that you are gay when you're young, it's gonna be really hard.
Well, yeah, or you just want to express another part of yourself. I mean, you know, these what we keep missing, I think, is that these gender normative things are very restrictive, you know, on and very tough on kids. That you know, there's one friend who I know who has a kid who's not gay, is not trans in any way, but is getting a lot of pressure at school because he wants to wear collared shirts. You know, that's somehow, you know, not the T-shirts that everybody else is wearing. You know, and this is that the boys are wearing. You know, and this is the kind of gender normative oppression that happens that is ridiculous and a waste of time. I mean, it's just a waste of time, and it's crazy.
We're talking to Sue O'Connor. You know, Sue, I read the story in The Atlantic, and there are a lot of liberal-leaning friends of mine who are celebrating this piece about... and I guess it all started in the National Review, a very conservative journal, and then ended up being written about in The Atlantic. And the National Review piece, obviously by a conservative, was better be careful here, because if you're celebrating Donald Trump going after Hunter Biden, then are you going to celebrate when President Kamala Harris, whoever, if a Democrat is president, goes after the Trump kids? And I was speaking to a friend last night who was saying how great this was. My attitude is they're all fair game. A little kid is not fair game.
No.
You know, when Chelsea Clinton was whatever or Amy Carter was whatever, it's when you have an adult who is in the world of commerce or government or whatever, if he or she allegedly violates some norms or laws or rules, the answer is they're fair game,
whether they're
a Trump kid or a Biden kid.
When Chelsea Clinton was being questioned a little bit about her role at the Clinton Foundation when Hillary was running, and suddenly there was don't talk to Chelsea about that, it's hands off. No, she's a grown woman.
She does have a position in the foundation, right?
And I think what's fascinating about this, and this is just Trump land craziness, you know, the same guy who's against chain migration, so-called chain migration, his in-laws are here thanks to chain migration. The same guy who's attacking Hunter Biden has his daughter, his son-in-law on the payroll, on the White House payroll, right? And his entire family on the payroll for the Trump campaign, right? So you could make a million arguments that a lot of the things that the Trump kids and in-laws have done are questionable and should be questioned, but it doesn't even bother him. Just attack Hunter Biden like, you know, this is some outlier that he's never heard of, a child, you know, making money off of parents.
Let's not forget that Don Jr. and Ivanka were facing indictment in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, Cy Vance, because they were selling condos in Trump Soho. First of all, it wasn't in Soho. But second of all, they were claiming that it was,
three-quarters
full.
The occupancy rate was nowhere near it was.
What about the deal? Didn't Ivanka get a deal in China?
China, yes.
You know, I mean, this is definitely one of these, it's not just because everyone does it sort of argument. It's just how can you dare to accuse somebody else of something that your own family and multitudes of them are doing?
Well, we should be clear, the two kids who he doesn't talk to, Tiffany and Barron, have been accused
good.
Of nothing.
They're clear. They've
been
apparently
accused
clear.
Of nothing.
They're clear.
No, they have accused him of some things, at least Tiffany has.
She has?
She has.
She has?
Remember the story about how she didn't want to be, he didn't want to do pictures.
Oh, right, exactly. Okay. So let's move on to the Pope, Marjorie, if we can. I know you like this story a lot.
Well, I do like this story because I'm a big fan of James Martin. And James Martin has written that the church, written a great book about how the church should calm down on gay issues. And in fact, it
was very Taylor Swift of you there.
Yeah. And in fact,
just calm down.
The book is called Building a Bridge: How the Catholic Church and the LGBT Community Can Enter into Relationship with Respect, Compassion, and Sensitivity. And he came to my parish and got a standing ovation. The place was absolutely packed. And at the end, I remember this couple from Fall River, where I'm from, who were in their 80s, went up and thanked him because they talked about how their son was driven out of participating in his parish in Fall River because he was gay. Mm-hmm. So
that's pretty great.
The Pope asked to speak. And I should also point out that James Martin, in a lot of these conservative Catholic parishes,
yeah, he was drummed out,
blacklisted.
Yeah.
He wasn't allowed to come speak. And there's this nutty group called Church Militant who goes bananas over these. They're very conservative. It goes bananas over gay people. Anyway, the Pope asked to meet with James Martin, which I thought was significant.
No, it definitely is. I mean, in the, you know, the Jesuits of the world, you know, trying to have the discussions that other folks don't want to have. And a reminder to people that, you know, here in wonderful liberal Massachusetts during the same-sex marriage battles, there were priests at the front of the church who said that if gays get the right to marry, old people won't get benefits and will die alone. There was actually a video that they used to show.
Can you believe that?
And we could never really figure out how they made the connection between us getting the right to marry and old people losing their benefits. But nonetheless, so it's not been a hospitable environment for us, to say the least. But I think this shows, I think when all is said and done, if we're all still around at the end of the Pope's papacy, that I think we'll find that he's made significant progress. Not the kind of progress that folks obviously want to see happen immediately, but I think that this is a step in the right direction.
You know, you're a fairly practical political thinker, and I want to run something by you that Marjorie and I were discussing with one of our coworkers the other day. I don't know if I should say who he is because I don't know if he said it on air. He was very concerned that if Trump were to lose the election, he would not leave the White House. Now, my suggestion, and some people thought this is irrational, is if he refused to leave, why can't they do exactly like the two popes are doing in the Vatican? That the prior pope just moved to the back of the house.
Just tell him he's still president. What if we just tell him he's still president and we buy Fox and we put on newscasts that say he's president?
So he'd be fine.
And then we could just move him to a different room.
So you agree with my fix for this
thing? I think that's a great
fix. Just move him to the back.
Just tell him he's still in charge. Fox News will just put a loop on, and he can watch that over and over again.
Well, I will say this for the Pope, too. As Bill McKibben has said many times, the best thing ever written about climate change was written by the Pope.
Yeah, that's but can I say something here? I'm glad we did the stories. I
know
how you
feel
about Martin.
He's horrible about sex abuse.
Until
we know that.
He deals with the sexual violence in the church, in my opinion, it doesn't matter how great he is and everything else. And I hope he's great on all those other things.
Well,
but
it matters.
No,
when you are in denial
and protecting people who have committed violent acts against children, I'm sorry.
But, well, with all due respect, Jim, that's a disgrace and it's awful. But to say it doesn't matter when you have a billion people around the world and Laudato Si is talked about all the time, that matters. That matters.
Well, it's not good enough for me. Okay, but, of course, I don't know. But I don't go. You go. So maybe you get, you know, quickly, because I want to talk about this GK25 thing.
Yep.
And I know you're involved with Colette Phillips, who we all love, obviously. Mm-hmm. But I read some things. We talked to you in advance of at least one of these LGBTQ political forums for the Democrats. Now they're over. And some people, I understand people are upset with Joe Biden because he treated the moderator pretty poorly, I think. And maybe he meant it was a joke, but it surely didn't come off as one. What are the reviews overall?
So I think the headline here is that things are good in the Democratic Party for the LGBTQ+ community, and that it was a historic night where folks were talking about drilling down into very, very deep issues and talking about the Equality Act and how it should pass. The things that some people are upset about, I find very, very specific, and I'm so happy about the fact that we're this deep in, right?
Mm-hmm.
We're
not like what, for example?
Like the sex work, right? So a number of LGBTQ+ people have to work in the sex industry, and our sex workers, because of the circumstance of where they are and the opportunities that they don't have. And
the candidates didn't address that issue.
They didn't address it, except I think, did Cory Booker address it? I think Cory Booker addressed it. So that was important. And, you know, Kamala Harris is continuing to have to struggle with the mantle she has as a prosecutor. You know, she has been tough on homeless kids in San Francisco, many of them LGBTQ+. So, but I think that if this is the level of detail that we're complaining about, which we should complain about, I think we're in good shape.
Okay, so can we go? You are part. You're part of this, Colette Phillips.
Yes, we did
Eastern
an event
Bank,
together. Yes.
Tell us about the event.
So last Thursday, Bay Windows, along with Colette Phillips, Get Connected, and Eastern Bank and Tufts Healthcare,
which does great stuff with Bob Rivers, is incredible.
Yeah, well, Colette and I had a lunch with Bob Rivers and said, "Hey, we want to do one of her Get Connected events, which you know are great and honor LGBTQ+ people." And Bob Rivers said, "We'd love to be a part of it, but you need to honor LGBTQ+." People of color. And we were both embarrassed that neither one of us had thought of that. So we went out and put a committee together, and we came up with 25 and then five sort of legacy folks to represent. Renee Graham's on the list from the Boston Globe. Ken Reeves, the former mayor of Cambridge. Denise Simmons, also the former mayor of Cambridge.
And current city council.
Javier Pagan from the Boston Police Department. Jerome Smith and Sam Chambers from Irene Monroe.
Irene, yeah.
Yeah, so we've got a great list, which you can see over at Bay Windows. We had a phenomenal night of just honoring these pioneers and these folks, and to have all of this wonderful talent and activism in the same room was really a magical night. So I'm thankful to everybody who came, and
it was
great.
Congratulations to all of you for doing it. It's really good.
Okay, Sue O'Connell.
Well done.
Media maven.
Nice to
see you. I'd love to talk to you.
See you at the hot food bar?
Yes.
Media maven.
Is it illegal if I use your discount?
I don't think so.
I think it's fine.
I think we're related.
Sort of family.
We're related.
I mean, it's
yeah,
fine.
We're
okay.
Family.
What's wrong with that? You don't tell anybody. Can you imagine getting a discount at the
Wouldn't
hot food?
Wouldn't that be like,
oh, God.
You know, I
God.
Can't look at
Doesn't
the underwear without thinking
that.
Of you there. You know that, right? I go around the corner and I'm like, oh, there's the underwear.
Well, I do buy the packed
buys.
Underwear.
I know, and it's like, that's what I think.
Oh, that's good underwear. I did
it's
not
really
know
that. High quality organic cotton. It's unbelievable.
He talks about it all the time. You must
smooth
have to
under skin.
Maybe I blocked it out.
It's unbelievable. I would if I were you.
Okay.
Nice to see you soon.
Media maven Sue O'Connell joins us every week. She's co-publisher of Bay Windows and the South End News, in-depth politics reporter for NECN, and the host of WGBH's Lunch Hour Live. Tomorrow you can catch Sue in conversation with award-winning chef Ming Tsai at the Boston Public Radio studio at the Boston Public Library from noon to 1. Thanks, Sue. Up next, how the whistleblower complaint is pushing the Trump administration to defy every norm of governing. National security expert Juliet Kayyem joins us for that and more on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Is it time for longtime member of Congress and the Senate, Ed Markey, to pass the torch? Joe Kennedy is calling for generational change. Will that be enough to woo millennial voters? Or is the almost millennial Kennedy just a little too moderate for their liking? West Politico's Stephanie Murray and journalist Miles Howard.
Then the Joker is back, but in today's climate of fear, and a mere 7 years after a Joker movie coincided with a mass shooting in a Colorado theater, will Joaquin Phoenix take on the classic Batman village inspire violence among theatergoers again? We'll ask WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen his thoughts. All that and more is coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Kristen Browdy. I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I apologize for my voice. I have a bit of a cold. Feel fine. Sound awful. Again, I apologize.
Glad you know, by the way, you know what I was going to do, Marjorie? I was going to introduce our next guest by listing the things that have happened in impeachment in the last 12 hours, but then I realized it would take the whole segment. So instead, I'm just going to introduce our next guest. Here with us is 03 to go over the latest on the impeachment front, what the situation is in the Bahamas, from which she just returned, and other national security headlines, is Juliet Kayyem. Juliet's an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. Hello there, Juliet Kayyem.
Hi, good afternoon.
Glad you're here.
So bring us up to date, Juliet, what may have happened the last hour since we've been on the air. We know that Pelosi and Schiff had a press conference.
Everything is fine. Everything is fine. So I don't even know the major headlines. I think the two of this morning are, of course, Pompeo admitting that he was on the Ukraine call after trying to sort of fudge his role in it. Last week he was sitting in the room, which then gets to issues about why the ambassador to the Ukraine resigned last week. He's going to testify this week. It looks like the State Department's, or not looks like, there's reporting that the State Department's IG, Inspector General, is seeking to meet with Congress on some emergency matter.
Yeah, when are they meeting? I keep waiting for you to have a time
I thought it was
announced.
This morning, too. I mean, which would suggest that Pompeo has lost a little bit of control over his capacity to determine who's going to testify or not before Congress. Volker is the ambassador who left. I now guess that Volker left so that he could testify without any concerns about what Pompeo did. I guess the second series of stories relate to, I mean, everything is just coming out now. So the president called Australia. Did the president call Boris Johnson? I mean, he was everywhere trying to promote AG Barr's investigation of the start of the Mueller complaint. And it's, I just want people to be clear, like, you know, I want to be clear here. This is all based on conspiracy theory, right-wing talking points. I mean, we have the Attorney General of the United States traveling around the world asking, outside of the chains of the ambassador or anyone else in those countries, asking intelligence services to provide information about, you know, conspiracy theories that started on these crazy websites. Like,
which would undermine our own intelligence agencies,
right,
which concluded unanimously that there was Russian
interference. Right, exactly. I think the third piece is, of course, the Pelosi-Schiff press conference today, this morning, of which, you know, they said they're proceeding with, of course, the impeachment investigation. The most important part, and this is why things are different and why Trump will find himself in a bind, is they view every obstruction of justice, every piece that is every time a cabinet secretary says they won't come, every time a cabinet secretary says my people won't come, they're viewing that as evidence for articles of impeachment. That's the bind that Trump is in right now, so, as compared to Mueller, which was, you know.
I know different. It's speculation, but you can do more informed speculation than either Marjorie or I can. What are people in your world suggesting this IG, the Inspector General, who's an independent player within the State Department, might consider to be so urgent? Obviously, he is smart enough to know that doing this is focusing intense speculation on him coming up against Pompeo.
I mean, there's two theories that everyone, this is more than speculation. IG would not rush to Congress, nor would he have authority to rush to Congress unless two things were happening. One was there is a whistleblower in the State Department of which the IG wants Congress to be aware of before all of this testimony.
And a whistleblower has to go through an inspector general.
That's
the next step.
How it does,
just
The second is that he has reason to believe that false statements were made to Congress already by State Department people, i.e. Pompeo, and wants to get there. So he's not going through Pompeo. Pompeo is in Italy or somewhere doing whatever Pompeo is doing on all these conspiracy theories. But, you know, so I think that's what's happening. But what you're seeing is that because the bottom is not holding for Trump now, it's always held before, you're just seeing these sort of bureaucratic mechanisms find their way to at least the majority party in the House, which just does make you realize how important 2018 was.
You know what was upsetting just on a personal, not me personally, but the State Department people, I think I have heard that they don't get government lawyers. They have to go out and hire their own lawyers. Remember this happened to the people that were around Bill Clinton when he was impeached?
It's happening to the people around Donald Trump when they were investigated.
And that's, that's the...
I find that horrible that in the course of your duties as a employee of the United States government, I know if I got in trouble when I worked for the Herald or for the Boston Globe, or I hope here for WGBH.
You do work at WGBH.
I do. I hope they'd hire my lawyer. I wouldn't have to go out and mortgage my house.
I mean, if it was within the scope of your employment.
But the claim is that it's not within their scope. I mean, this is the decision that the White House people are going to have to face right now, is the extent to which they want to go down that path. Now, my understanding is that the Trump reelect money has been going to support some of these people, which is, I don't know how that's possible, or some sort of pool of money for
Didn't he meet
elections.
With Wayne LaPierre the other day to try to get Wayne NRA money to help with his defense and maybe the defense of his allies?
Right.
Can I ask you another legal question? Then I want to get your opinion on something impeachment related. CNN is reporting this morning, as are other outlets, but I saw it on CNN, that Rudy Giuliani is contemplating suing Congress overstepping their bounds. What is the basis? I understand you can decide not to comply, in which case Congress has to act, and then you can defend yourself. What is the basis for somebody who receives a subpoena to sue the subpoenaing entity? And what's the basis for that?
None. I mean, Rudy is desperately holding on to righteousness is, I think, the only legal defense he has right now, at least his own sense of righteousness. Rudy is in a lot of trouble. I mean, first of all, the White House views him as expendable. So he's now isolated from the White House.
The president liked him.
The president, I've read that, that's a like of one, right? When the president's lawyers tell Trump, it's impeachment or Giuliani. Come on. Trump has never been loyal to anyone. So Giuliani is just floundering in ways that, he's not well. I mean, I think it's
Chris
safe
Cuomo
to say.
Interview in and of itself, if people find what Giulietta is saying troubling, just Google the interview and listen. Within a nanosecond, he contradicts himself on
about
whether
the
or not
Ukraine thing.
He ever broached the Biden thing with Ukraine.
And he was acting as an agent of the president with no official title outside the chains of communication and bureaucracy and the intelligence agencies and an ambassador to get dirt on Biden. And now we know that the president also did it, was trying to do that with Australia, was trying to do that likely with England. He was calling leaders directly to have them get dirt on his, one of the candidates that was going to run against him. So let alone Ukraine. So that's just a sort of is that an impeachable offense in and of itself?
So here's the opinion part
I mean,
of
that's
this thing.
This
is a question to you as a Democrat that I have been borderline obsessed with because I do want a fair and full investigation. And then the chips fall where, as they know, people know what they're saying.
Competent would be good, too.
The two, the two examples we've had so far of committee chairs who are Democrats leading part of this investigation, in my opinion, were in two embarrassments. We had Jerry Nadler, who was almost as pathetic as Corey Lewandowski at that hearing. They both should be ashamed. And then we had Adam Schiff, who I generally have a lot of respect for, the House Intelligence Committee chair, opening something as serious as an impeachment inquiry into a president of the United States. And doing that moronic mobster analogy is not only childish, it is so to use the word Nancy Pelosi uses, somber, so unsomber, so unrespectful of the constitutional process that it worries me that they don't have anybody who has the ability to deal with this.
Right. I think Adam Schiff heard it loud and clear, and I think that's probably why Nancy Pelosi had him with her, because she's let's just talk about masterful. I mean, I sometimes just think about Seth Moulton, who opposed her, and I'm like, explain that.
Jim.
Sorry.
Well, see, I don't think, by the way, the place where we have a disagreement, which we don't have to explore because we've done it ad nauseum this week, I don't think Nancy Pelosi decided last week to initiate an impeachment inquiry. No, she was led by her members. Her members were essentially saying, with all due respect, Madam Speaker, we're not with you. The numbers grew, she had no choice.
I am totally of the school that she mapped it out exactly like that. When she had the numbers, she had those eight Congress people who had served write the article in the Washington Post. The Ukraine thing breaks, and the next day she does it.
Do you think it was planned out by her?
I think she greased the runway like there was no tomorrow.
I hope you're right.
Ask you a question, Julie. Elliot Kaim, Esquire.
Yes.
I heard another one of my favorite podcasts, Preet Bharara's, this morning, and he was arguing with the former...
Incredible.
Well, at least...
No, it's great that you're doing all this. Good.
It's pathetic.
Obsessed.
It's
I know,
pathetic.
But it's great. You should be obsessed.
I mean,
go
this
ahead.
Is what I do. I
okay,
listen to this all day long. Anyway, he said that the Democrats are in real danger of screwing this up because they don't know how to ask questions, and they
right.
don't.
And they you should
know,
have. They should
they
have.
Need
a lawyer. Yeah.
And I don't think there's any talk of that at all. It's like when Chris Matthews, and you're an interviewer all the time. I used to be an
Pointing
interviewer. I guess I still am in
you
the radio.
Are,
but
yes,
anyway, when people like Stephen Miller refuse to answer the question, or Jim Jordan, are you okay with the president going to a foreign power to intervene in our elections? They dance. They
yeah.
dance. And he said what they have to do is
Chris
go back
Wallace
and
was
ask
brilliant
the
in that
same
instance.
Question.
Yeah.
And then if they refuse to answer it the third time, then you just say, okay, clearly.
You won't answer the question.
Chris Wallace was remarkable.
So I don't know. Is it just their egos?
Yeah.
That's pretty pathetic.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, who would
because
who
they're
would
not
be
helping.
Right. Who would be qualified to do it? I mean, I
they
don't know what
they mentioned some
thinking.
Lawyers. They mentioned yeah. some good litigators. I can't tell you the names. I didn't write them down. But people that could do it. And by
Marjorie,
the way.
The Republicans scoured the country
Jim,
to pick a
Jim,
prosecutor.
Had,
excuse me. Let me finish.
Oh, yeah,
sentence,
for Kavanaugh.
To do Christine Blasey Ford. She was one of the worst lawyers yeah. I've ever seen in my life.
Well, I think it probably said something about which woman in America wants to be grilling. Christine Blasey Ford in front of the whole world. I think they maybe have had trouble getting a good litigator. You'd have no trouble getting
right.
But you know why you and
right.
Preet Bharara are on a losing path, even though I may agree with you? It's not just ego. I agree with Juliet on that. The average constituent never sees their member of Congress,
exactly.
except when they're asking a question
exactly.
at a hearing. They're never
they
given
don't
that up.
Know how yeah. to ask
so that's the
questions.
That's the right that you can train
it is a
for
skill.
Right,
you need
that
to
you
learn.
Can train for, and one would hope that they have a strategy for what questions they're going to ask and not get deflected. It was clear in the Corey Lewandowski one they hadn't
disaster.
Met before disaster. I mean, I think the only benefit of that is he's not running for Senate, I think, anymore because
apparently not.
Because of the line,
help
yeah,
Trump got reelected.
Right. Because that's
by the
most
way,
important.
Some, we should be clear. Some people, Kamala Harris,
yeah.
former prosecutor, fabulous questioner,
right.
Ocasio-Cortez, fabulous,
who's not
fabulous.
A lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
She's
that's
terrific.
A good point.
Yeah.
She's not
right.
a lawyer.
It's just doing your homework.
I'm not a lawyer either, Jim.
You're not. Thank you. Well, I sort of was. In any case, we're talking to Juliet Kaim. Before we leave, I didn't know that you'd been in the Bahamas till a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
I'm dying to talk to you about. Is there any aspect of this impeachment thing we haven't touched upon that you think?
No, I mean, I do think that I think that the way the Democrats have set it up is just really smart in the sense that the failure to comply, this is something that Mueller didn't have in his favor. The failure to comply will be viewed as substantive evidence for an impeachable defense. So he is in a bind. I think the other thing that's just sort of not surprising, because obviously, we knew it at the beginning, but just the Ukraine story is so easy to grasp.
Right. We've
and
said
it's
that repeatedly.
In real time.
I agree.
But I think what I can't believe is the number of people who must have been involved in this totally inappropriate, unconstitutional conspiracy, and then involved with the cover-up. I mean, dozens of people. And then you have Barr, you have Pompeo, that it took this long to break, right? I mean, and then, but, you know, kudos to the Washington Post, man. They own this story. I mean, it is remarkable. So I just think, you know, I mean, I don't know how this ends. This is another one that he gets out of. It does feel different. And I do, you know, but, you know, Trump has surprised us all. Although, I one more thing. I think what you are seeing is the idea that he's invincible, I think, has shed, so that you do have people now saying things. And I think one of the scariest things he has to be thinking of is, where is McConnell? McConnell is not, I mean, McConnell said that he will have to have a trial, but McConnell has not, put it a different way, just how we were talking about Nancy Pelosi, these senators who are starting to criticize Trump or say, you know, it was inappropriate, you wonder if that was vetted by McConnell.
That's a very good point. Grassley, the most senior Republican, said a whistleblower has to be respected and protected.
Have we heard? I should know this. I don't. Have we heard from Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski?
Please.
She said last week
concerned.
That she, because the matter may come before the Senate,
meaning that there may be an impeachment and they may have to make a determination.
Concerned.
She will. She feels it's inappropriate to comment.
Yeah, she's very concerned. She's very concerned. Let me tell you one thing. One thing that the president is doing, the sort of a side, not a side thing. I think it's consistent with his anger towards the whistleblower, his talk of civil war, his talk of a coup. This is something that I've talked about with you both a lot, which is this is his use of stochastic terrorism to incite violence. I don't think we're going to have a civil war. I don't think this is a coup. But definitely certain portions of his supporters are hearing that violence is
completely
acceptable as a means to stop whatever these impeachment proceedings are.
And Adam Schiff has committed treason, according to him, and treason is punishable by death.
Right. Although I think, in fairness, there were Democrats that called the Clinton impeachment a coup as well. I think that word was used
before. But I don't think Clinton did.
No, Clinton,
yeah, exactly.
I don't think Clinton
exactly,
did.
Right.
So what?
Oh, so
why
I was
in the Bahamas.
I was just doing some recovery work. We were sort of assessing how the recovery is going. I went with Miles O'Brien from PBS and Nova and all that. He's fantastic, and sort of looking at both the science and the response efforts for documenting, as well as I'll have a piece in the Washington Post tomorrow. It's bad. And yet it's a very complicated place. 60% of the tourism there, I'm sorry, 60% of the economy there is based on tourism. 85% of that 60% is U.S. tourism, including the cruise ships. So they have a very strong invested interest in sort of selling that the Bahamas are back. And they are. 14 of the 16 islands are open for business. The hurricane, for whatever reason, didn't touch them. They have these two big islands, Abaco and the Grand Bahamas, that are devastated beyond belief. And Abaco ends up being the most difficult one. It's where Dorian sort of sat for 24 hours. They have probably up to 10,000 evacuees now in Nassau. They're in shelters. There are questions about whether they're going to rebuild in Abaco and how they're going to rebuild. Are these climate refugees or are they evacuees? I think it's the ultimate question. There's also a racial component. Most of them are Haitian, who sort of had second-class citizenship in the Bahamas and worries that they might be sent back to Haiti.
How many people are still missing?
Over 1,000. So that sort of opens up my column. Opens up with something I heard from an aid worker, which is you can smell the bodies, but you can't see them. There's just a sense that there's lots of bodies under the rubble and stuff. They're trying to get them. The government has only said 56 have died. That's just a bogus number. It's a placeholder. There are at least, you talk to coroners and others. I talk to aid workers. Everyone has a story. I saw three bodies here. I saw four bodies here. It's now a month later. Normally, body pickup sort of happens within the first week if you can do it.
How helpful are we being, the United States?
The U.S. itself was very helpful in the response, Coast Guard and others. I think the long-term recovery efforts are still a question. But just to be fair, the Caribbean has a very, very extensive sort of humanitarian effort that, from France and not just the U.S. and Canada. These aid organizations are going to be there a while. You have Chef Jose doing, his food thing. We saw his food trucks. He's absolutely incredible. And I think that the question, I had a chance to think about my own profession. So we used to have an idea, that storms were random and rare, so that after they came through a place, you just immediately, the question was, how and when would you rebuild? And I think that this poses a good question about, not just how, when, but whether you actually are going to commit to rebuilding a Caribbean island has an altitude of, essentially 2 feet. And what would that look like to tell people they can't go home?
Well, speaking of that, and you got to see it firsthand, and I'm sure speak to people firsthand. I was watching CNN, your network, last night, and they interviewed this older guy who had seen his wife die, and she died. And the reporter, I don't know who it was for CNN.
Patrick Oberman, I was with him,
Is right at where the guy's house was. Yeah. There's nothing left. And he starts talking. And it's one thing to just report that.
Yeah.
The guy himself talks about, I know my wife, the love of my life.
Yeah. Don't have my house.
He motions to what was his house, which is total rubble.
Yeah.
And it's so
painful. I talked to an evacuee and And he said to me, you know, I said, you know, he goes, I want to go back to Abaco. And I said, you know, aren't there going to be more storms? And doesn't that scare you to recommit there? And he said, you know, God wouldn't put us through that again. And you're like, right. God, you know, I mean, it's just, but there's also just this idea of home, right? That's your safe space. And yet these homes are not there and they may not come back. And the government has yet to make a decision in this regard. They're doing a whole sort of planning process, which is probably smart. But the problem is you do a planning process while people are waiting to hear their destiny. And there's just a lot of tension and frustration.
You know, Emily Rooney told us a story about a friend of hers that has a golf course in Florida. And he built a golf course in the Bahamas mm-hmm. to Florida hurricane withstanding standards. I know that the water level will get rid of things no matter what, but it survived, and it was on the Big Island, I believe.
She said one of the few buildings that
did. Yeah, and so I wonder.
Must have been on Grand Bahamas, yeah.
But of course, probably to build to those standards, just like they try to build to earthquake standards in California, is very expensive and would be just not possible even if they could do
zoning and require. The difference between Abaco and Grand Bahamas is, which is just interesting, the Grand Bahamas did have zoning requirements about roofs, at least. So when you fly over, it looks fine. I mean, you just see lots of roofs. The problem is the water surge. People died from that. And there's a sort of conventional wisdom that most of the bodies are out to sea. But you talk to enough aid workers, and they're inside this rubble. And as they start to get rid of the rubble, because the roof stayed on, but the water comes up to the roof. So people, you know, die. And it's for 24 hours, right? I mean, it's not like a flash flood. It is 24 hours of trying to maintain it. So, you know, I'm really interested, you know, you guys know my work. I'm, you know, sort of interested in, you know, recovery and resiliency and sort of these decisions that are going to have to be made by these by many countries about how they move forward.
A lot of states like Massachusetts have to make those very same
decisions.
And
these storms are getting bigger and they're getting longer and they're getting more violent, and you know what does that mean for these communities?
Well, the climate crisis tells you that because of the warming water, that this stalling phenomenon, which happened, as you pointed out, in the Bahamas, is going to be more frequent because the warming water has to do. I don't understand the biology of it enough, but it causes
climatology, not the biology.
I don't understand it, but I do know
it's a low pressure keeps
because
it.
Because we talked just yesterday about how the warming waters here, if the lobster business is going moving to Canada.
Exactly.
The lobsters are swimming to Canada.
Yeah,
so
exactly. No, it is. I mean, all these changes, but the big storms are coming. So we've documented. I'll have the piece out. So, but it was. You know, I'll say on the good news front. If you ever want faith in mankind, people who are part of this sort of global relief effort, and in fact the survivors. This sense of optimism, this sense of can do, this sense of help. Like, you know, you just meet. I was on the airplane. I landed. I had to go through Florida, and I was on the airplane and just started talking to a guy. I clearly was an aid worker, and he said, you know, I'm from Puerto Rico. I live in California, so I'm from Puerto Rico. And he said, I couldn't go help Puerto Rico. And then when this happened, I talked to my wife. He's a doctor, and I'm going out there for 6 weeks. And you're just like, who are you?
Well, you
like,
know, you mentioned Jose Andres before. Yeah. I had Ming Tsai and Ken Oranger, two of the celebrated chefs in town, who actually went to the Bahamas to work with Andres. And they made the point that when Andres went to the islands, it was 2 days before Dorian hit. He had no idea if he was about to set up in the path of the hurricane.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he was putting himself at great risk,
too.
Yeah,
he's unbelievable. Nobel
Peace Prize.
He's gone
all over the world.
Nobel Peace Prize.
Well, actually, if it's rigged, because the president should
be winning
it otherwise.
Exactly, it is rigged.
That's what he said. Nice to see you.
Okay, bye, you guys.
Congratulations on your trip. That's really great. Your piece will be in the Post tomorrow.
Yeah.
Washington Post tomorrow. Juliette Kayyem.
Okay, bye,
see
guys.
Ya.
National security expert Juliette Kayyem joins us every week. She's an analyst for CNN, former assistant secretary at the Department of Homeland Security, and faculty chair of the Homeland Security Program at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Up next, the president's immigration policies have an immigrant community too scared to engage with law enforcement when a 5-year-old girl goes missing. Ali Narani joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Amidst the global refugee crisis, a new executive order slashes the number of refugees who will be able to come to the U.S. to an historic low. Another move from the Trump administration gives cities and states the authority to refuse to resettle refugees there. As Ellie Noronha put it in a recent op-ed for Fox News, our country is hurtling down a shameful path, one in which we undermine our security, our economy, and our moral leadership in the world. Ali joins us on the line to talk about this and other immigration headlines. He is the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. The latest book from him is There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. He is also a BPR contributor. Ali, it's good to talk to you as always.
Thank you for having me. How are you?
Great. Fine, thank you, Ali. Well, I wanted to start with a story that I just learned about last night, and I'm wondering if you had heard rumors to this effect before, that in a new book written by two New York Times reporters discusses how the president at one point was hoping to build a moat instead of a wall along the border, to fill the moat with alligators and snakes and to shoot people in the legs, not fatally, but in the legs, to incapacitate them as they tried to come into the United States. Had you heard about this?
Yeah, so earlier this fall, I had heard that this book was nearing publication. It's a book being written by Michael Shear and Julie Hirschfield Davis, both reporters for the New York Times. And I'd been hearing bits and pieces about it over the year, or the last couple of years, in fact, as I've been doing research. You know, the way I thought about when I first started the story last night and kind of read that, the president said in the Oval Office that, you know, the United States should be shooting migrants in the legs to shoot them, to slow them down. I was really grappling with, okay, how do you respond to that? And then I realized, you know what? Every now and then, words are worth thousands of pictures. And I just think that it's pretty shocking that, you know, the president feels like this is a completely appropriate thing to say in the Oval Office about, you know, the way that the United States should be treating migrants.
You know, we were talking this morning, Marjorie and I, about the book, and which I don't think is out for a few days. I think it's the 8th or something like that. And trying to figure out, even if you are the most pro-Trump, anti-immigration person, can anybody defend this? In Marjorie's analysis, the only way you can defend it is to say it's a lie, that it's fake news. But that nobody can say this is the way to treat a fellow human being. But then I said to myself, after Marjorie said that, we said months ago, nobody could suggest the kid should be separated from his or her parents or put in a cage. And it seems that a decent percentage of the population was okay with that too. So I assume they'll be okay with crocodiles and snakes and shooting people in the leg. We're talking to Ali Noronha.
Ali, tell
and
us.
You know,
go ahead. No, go ahead. Finish what you're going to say.
Yeah, so, you know, I've been doing immigration advocacy for a long time, and I always try to, like, take a step back and not to personalize the advocacy in terms of really kind of personally call into question the values of the policymaker. I think policymakers make really, really difficult decisions. But you know what? If you are in the room and your boss says something like this, you have, I think, a moral responsibility to look yourself in the mirror the next morning and ask yourself, do I want to go to work today? Do I want to work for this person? So, you know, Jim, you're right. It's like, I think there are probably a number of Trump supporters out there who are saying, okay, this sounds good. But those people in that room who were trying to figure out, okay, what do I do with this? That's a highly personal decision of whether or not they go to work the next day.
Well, we do know this much from the book is that while there was apparently no effort to price the cost of the alligators and the snakes, there was an effort to price the cost of the moat. And they reported back to the president, the people in the Homeland Security Department, that a moat would be too expensive. It would cost a lot more than the wall. So apparently that's why they abandoned the moat idea. But anyway, Ali Noronha, a story out of Bridgeton, New Jersey, involving a 5-year-old girl who went missing from a playground. Can you tell us the story?
Sure. This is just a tragic story. It's a Bridgeton, Jersey. It's a small kind of rural town, and you know, it's probably even listeners realize this, but Jersey has this massive rural community. But this particular town, over the years, has really become a safe haven for the Latino community. It's become a community that I think people have really enjoyed raising their families in. So one afternoon, a mother, Ms. Alves Perez, takes her children to the local park, and her daughter, 5-year-old Dulce, is kidnapped and disappears. And the story is striking because it calls into question on the part of the immigrant community in this town whether or not they can trust local law enforcement. Because her boyfriend, in the weeks after the disappearance, he's detained by Immigration and Customs Enforcement. He was eventually released, but a community, much less a family, traumatized by the disappearance of their daughter, for Immigration and Customs Enforcement to come in and say, you know what, your boyfriend is undocumented, we're going to detain him, it makes it 10 times harder for the community to trust local law enforcement. And along the way, it makes everybody, immigrants or not, in that particular community less safe.
Well, what happens to the little girl?
She, as far as I know, has not been found yet.
What I read in the story is that an Amber Alert later identified a man wearing orange sneakers, red pants, and a black shirt as a person of interest, that he came with a van and lured her into the van, and she's on the FBI's list of high-profile kidnapping victims.
And, you know, it seems that the business community locally has really engaged. There's been an award posted, a restaurant owner. It's a big park, like 1,100 acres. He put his drone up in the air to look for clues. But, you know, as of my last reading, young Dulce hasn't been found yet.
But do we know how the police came to know about this disappearance? Someone obviously reported it to the police.
So when the incident occurred, the mother called the police immediately. So she immediately engaged police. It's kind of the follow-on of, you know, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, you know, suddenly appearing on the scene and her husband being detained.
Yeah.
The story's not clear kind of how her husband kind of found himself in that space. But, you know, why is ICE all of a sudden kind of pushing a community further away from law enforcement at this moment?
We're talking to Ali Noorani. Ali, can we talk about a couple of regulations, if that's what they're appropriately called, from the Trump administration? Explain to us what they are and what the consequences are. The first is this thing, which I believe would give states and cities the power to reject the resettlement of refugees in their communities. How does this work and what does it mean?
Sure. So this was part of last week's announcement by the administration to continue to lower the ceiling for refugee resettlement in the U.S. So the administration set the ceiling, in essence, the maximum number at 18,000 people to be resettled in the U.S. The same day, practically in the same breath, they issued an executive order that granted the authority to local cities and towns and states to kind of to be able to say whether or not they will accept refugees. Now, this goes all the way back to, in many ways, to 2015, when you had, you know, Governor Pence.
Indiana did, right. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Right. I think he was one of, 25 Republican governors across the country who said, you know what, we don't want refugees in our state. I believe that, to his credit, Governor Baker did not sign that letter.
Mm-hmm. This was Syrian refugees in Indiana, was it not, that he was targeting?
Precisely. Yeah. So the Trump administration, now that they're in power, they have said, okay, let's see this through. So this executive order makes a statement. It requires that localities have to prove in a publicly issued statement that they will that they are welcoming of refugees. It's not clear entirely how it's all going to be implemented because at the end of the day, what's the relationship between a city saying yes and a state saying no? What type of evidence needs to be shown? And it has really the potential to be a pretty ugly political debate, but I imagine it will also have some time in the courts as well.
Why shouldn't a community or a state be able to make that decision?
Because at the end of the day, refugee resettlement is an immigration policy overall is a federal decision. So let's say Boston decides that they're going to resettle. Mayor Walsh says, we're going to continue to welcome refugees. Isn't that refugee from Cameroon who comes to Boston, are they not allowed to move to, Manchester? Because Manchester says they don't want. So we end up in this really, really dicey and area of, you know, are we actually limiting the movement of residents of the United States? And that's a slope that we've never been on as a nation.
Tell us about Vice President Mike Pence and the Syrian refugees, Ali Noorani.
So back in 2015, when we saw the Syrian refugee crisis really start to spike across the country, Governor Pence then, along with, like I said, I think 25 other governors, sent a letter to the Obama administration, in essence, barring the resettlement of Syrian refugees. That, you know, the Obama administration, I don't think they paid any attention to that letter, but it certainly became a big part of the political debate. I do know that in Indiana, there was a lawsuit in Indiana from a local community organization, and then it was actually the state attorney general, Greg Zeller at that time, a Republican attorney general, who kind of devised a legal strategy to kind of see the case through and kind of stretch the case, because it was his job to represent the governor's office in this lawsuit. But then the next day, he was at the airport, Indianapolis airport, welcoming Syrian refugees, because, you know, Greg Zeller is a devout Catholic and a member of the Catholic Charities Board of Directors. So in a place like Indiana, you saw politics run into culture and into faith in a really, really interesting way.
You know, it's interesting. It's worth quoting from the judge, this appellate court judge, Richard Posner, in this around Indiana. He says he, and I'm reading verbatim, he, meaning Pence, argues that his policy of excluding Syrian refugees is based not on nationality and thus is not discriminatory, but is based solely on the threat he thinks they pose, meaning Syrians, to the safety of residents of Indiana. And the judge continues to write, but that's the equivalent of him saying, though he doesn't explicitly say it, that he wants to forbid black people from settling in Indiana, not because they're black, but because he's afraid of them. And since race is therefore not his motive, he isn't discriminating. But of course, that would be racial discrimination, just as his targeting Syrian refugees is discrimination on the basis of nationality. That is now, he is now obviously the president, the vice president of the United States. And we started this discussion talking about the timing coincided with the with Donald Trump putting a ceiling, lowering the cap on refugee admissions, I think from what, 45,000 to 18,000. Or something like that. And I think one of the you were talking a minute ago about why didn't people who were in that room when we were talking crocodiles and shooting migrants in the legs speak up? Apparently, even though it's after the fact, one of the people who had a problem with this was Jim Mattis, saying things. I believe what he said was, you know, we have people like in Iraq who are sacrificing their life, Iraqis, to side with us. And then we say, to protect your life after you've protected the lives of our people, you can't come to this country. Why would anybody take a risk on our behalf if we thought we wouldn't take a risk for them? And I thought, again, I wish he had said that when he was working in the White House, but that's a wonderful explanation as to why this refugee cap, beyond being inhumane, is also not in our national interest, Ellie.
Absolutely. And the administration tried to get around that with the cap last week by allocating a certain number of that 18,000 to, you know, those to individuals who helped the arms or U.S. Army or armed services in Iraq or Afghanistan. So they tried to get around it. But what Mattis and other experts in the national security realm say is that, OK, yes, it's important that somebody can seek refuge who has helped us overseas. But it's also an example of our soft power to be able to say to a country like Honduras or, you know, again, the Cameroon or China, to be able to say, you know what, if you are going to persecute right. your citizens, they can seek protection here. And this cap takes away that soft power as for the United States.
And by, I'm assuming, before we let you go, that both of these policies, this executive order allowing cities, towns, and states to decide they don't want the resettlement of refugees and the lowering of the refugee admission cap, I assume they either have been or will be challenged. Yes?
The cap will not be challenged. I mean, the cap
Why?
Could be challenged and because that is administration.
He has unilateral power to do that. Okay.
Yeah. I do think that the executive order will be challenged in the courts, certainly.
Fair enough, Allie. As always, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for the update. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Allie.
Hey, thank you.
Boston Public Radio contributor Ali Narani joins us regularly. He's the executive director of the National Immigration Forum. His latest book is There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Up next, with the vaping industry going up in smoke, Jewel is bringing in executives from Big Tobacco. And we're going to talk about whether or not you can have a cheeseburger for dinner tonight, another one tomorrow for lunch. Art Kaplan joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Join us online to go over the latest headlines involving healthcare, policy, and ethics. As Art Kaplan. Art is the doctor's William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and the Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Lengo Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. And most importantly, he comes from the same hometown as Adam Schiff. Congratulations on that, Art Kaplan.
Hey, not only do I come from the same hometown, but same neighborhood.
Is that true?
Really?
We both grew up in a part of Framingham called Saxonville. Yep. And there's been a little bit of tweeting about the Roll of Honor with Schiff getting the majority of the attention, but a few brave souls have pointed out that I was his neighbor. Yeah.
Okay, so before we do that, who are the most famous? By the way, years ago when I was looking at Central High School, which is fairly legendary in Philadelphia, on Wikipedia, and they had their most famous graduates, I was not on it. And so one of our former staff people, I shouldn't even say this, Tori Bedford, put me on it. I know that may have, and maybe I crossed the line there, but I am on it now, and it's Wikipedia.
Wait a minute. You hacked into the list.
It's not hacking. No, I didn't hack anything. Tori did what she did, but so if there was a list of the most,
she's your employee.
Can
Jim.
We move on, please? My coworker. Can we? If we had to make a list very quickly, the most famous people who were born in Framingham, who would be on that list? Thank you. We appreciate it.
Hold on.
Nancy Travis, who's an actress.
Oh, okay. I've heard of her.
She's from Framingham.
I Kaplan.
Yeah, there's me. And Schiff. Schiff is big.
Yeah, he's big. Yeah. Okay.
What do you call people from Framingham? Are they Framingham tights or?
Yes, Framingham tights. Framingham tights. Yes.
Framinghamites.
Okay. Let's move on, but we're really honored to have you as our point there, Art Kaplan. Thank you.
Thank you. I apologize for my voice, Art. I'm raspy today. So, Art, there's this piece in the Washington Post from a day or two ago pointing out that the Affordable Care Act has had a huge positive impact on the poor in states which expanded Medicaid. What'd they find?
So there's been this constant drumbeat that we ought to pull back the Affordable Care Act. Trump and the Republicans have made that sort of their health care plan. I don't know what their substitute is, but they certainly don't like the Affordable Care Act. But if you look at this study, and by the way, Marjorie, I think there are over at least 150 studies that have been looking at the impact of Medicaid coverage offered by the federal government under the Affordable Care Act to states. It's been a tremendous success. So you get self-reported improvements in health by Medicaid recipients. They say they're doing better with their diabetes or whatever it is. It seems to have been useful in getting better coverage for opioid abusers in terms of getting treatment. It is one rollicking good success. Covering more of the uninsured under Medicaid really is bringing them both better utilization. You know, they don't all stack up in the emergency room, if you remember those days. And then just really a benefit for their health. So I think the data supports, you know, let's keep doing this.
You know, there are two things that stuck out to me. Well, three things. One, they gave some examples of individuals who realistically would have been dead or in debt for their whole lives were it not for the ACA. Really powerful examples. Number two, I'm reminded reading this Washington Post piece that only three dozen governors took the expanded Medicaid money. The other a third should be Something horrible should happen to these people. It is totally indefensible.
May I just give an example of that? There was a devastating piece a couple of months ago now. Art, you probably saw it in the New York Times, in Tennessee, where the governor and the politicians there, because they were opposed to Obama, rejected the federal money.
It's free money from the federal government.
Which and that's free Medicaid money is what we're talking about. So it's for poor people.
But they said for the...
Yeah, there is an argument.
And old people.
There is, and disabled people too, by the way. That's the other group in Medicaid. You might put in a policy that Jim would like, I think, which should say whatever the minimal coverage is in the state, that's what the governor gets.
I'm fine with that, but we'll finish
Tennessee. I just wanted to point out this Tennessee story. That it was a story about people lining up, and it reminded me of Black Friday when people used to line up outside of, you know, Best Buy at like midnight the night before and camp out. This is what people were doing. They were lining up in tents outside these free clinics. They were desperately poor people who, because of political reasons, their politicians denied them free money from the federal government for health care, and this is what they were reduced to, going to free clinics and standing in line for hours. People that were old, people
and
that were
by
disabled.
The way, what you're describing, Marjorie, is not really a free clinic. It's like a free mobile tent rolling clinic. That is, they run them in, they set them up. It's a great thing that healthcare workers and people are doing, but it's not like they have a fixed site or something like that. They're just coming in once in a while to help out. Dentistry, too, a little bit. So, you know, I don't think we want to follow the kind of distribution pattern of the circus, with a tent and, you know, people having to roll into town to put on a show. We ought to get basic care for everybody. You know, it's cheaper. It's cheaper in the long run. The earlier you can prevent things, the cheaper it is. The more you can manage chronic conditions and not let them deteriorate, the cheaper it is for all of us. It's ridiculous not to cover people for these basic services.
One last thing, observation from this Washington Post piece. I'll read you a paragraph that I never thought about, but it was stunning. With about 20 million Americans now covered through private health plans under the ACA's insurance marketplace for Medicaid expansions, researchers have been focusing, this is the whole point of the article, on a question that was not an explicit goal of the law, whether anyone is healthier as a result. That's almost like an SNL kind of statement. We want to expand care, is that a fair statement that it was not an explicit goal whether anyone got healthier as a result of expanded coverage?
Well, I think people who were for this kind of presumed that they'd get healthy, which is why all these studies keep popping up. The critics, I don't know what they thought. I think maybe there's this idea that you know, you're not really sick until you show up half dead in the emergency room, so you don't need any health care.
Yeah.
Okay. So, Art Kaplan, I want you to know, last night, as quickly as I could before this Annals of Internal Medicine analysis of red meat and processed meat, before they rescinded it or was discredited, I went home and had 3 steaks and 2 packages of hot dogs. Because I just wanted to get it.
And a couple of smokes.
I just wanted to get it in before. We discussed this with Corby Kummer, who was our food guy yesterday. I think it's fair to say that Corby was skeptical, to say the least. And was sort of on the side of the T.H. Chan people and the cardiology people and whatever. You know, there are 2 issues. One, are they right to suggest that the evidence is not strong enough to suggest you should dramatically limit your intake of red meat and processed meat, other than the climate change effects? And 2, what this does to the average American's ability to decide who's telling the truth about nutrition is frightening. But you could speak to either of them.
So I'm going to tell you whose side I'm on in this fight about red meat. And by the way, we're just talking about the health impacts.
Right.
As you just said, Jim, you know, there's still an argument about burden on the environment and using up too much water to feed the cows and all that. But put all that to the side as a reason to eat less meat. Is it good or bad for you? So here's my scientist that I trust, Plato.
What did he say again?
Moderation in all things, excess in none. Back in the Gorgias, one of his dialogues. And Aristotle picked it up. It was a notion of a golden mean. I think everything in public health is like a long footnote to the idea that You can eat all kinds of things and do all kinds of things. You just have to be moderate. You shouldn't eat steak every day. You shouldn't eat it twice a day. You should try to have some vegetables and fruits. You know, I know we want to turn this into a tell me how many portions I can eat before I drop dead kind of discussion. But I don't think the evidence does support that quite yet. There's weak evidence that eating a lot of red meat is associated with increased health risks like cancer and heart disease, but it's weak. I looked at the papers. They're right. The data isn't strong. And the reason is we can't do controlled trials.
Of course.
We can't set up experiments with people to say, okay, you guys eat steak every day, you know, for 2 years, and then your neighbor will eat vegetables every day for 2 years. Really hard to do that. So what you have is observational studies. It looks like the places where you eat more meat seem to have bigger health problems, but then you find exceptions and places where it isn't true and you're not quite sure why. So just be moderate, you know. Let's not wait for the resolution of the exact number of steaks you can eat before you're going to
you know,
wheeze
hey
off.
Art, do you know who on this show yesterday said the very same thing emphatically? That would
oh,
be Plato Egan right
Plato
here.
Plato Egan, yeah.
She was she's a big moderation kind of gal, too. I'm a big excess kind of guy, so it's a little harder for me.
When we grew up in Framingham, we knew 6 cheeseburgers a day. No more.
So, Art Kaplan, as you know, the governor of Massachusetts has put a 4-month ban on vaping products until people figure out what's going on with the deaths and the severe lung injuries.
Only ban in the country like that, by the way.
Yep,
that
we're
goes
ahead
beyond
of the game.
The flavored products.
But meanwhile, we've learned that Juul has replaced its CEO with a guy from the cigarette giant Altria. And I heard this morning on the radio, right here on WGBH, that in this short time since the new CEO has come in, they're obviously taking a new strategy where the cigarette giant has now decided, the new CEO guy has decided, we're not going to fight these bans here and elsewhere. We're going to look more like a concerned citizen. And I guess Juul had spent millions of dollars fighting different kind of restrictions all around the country. So the tobacco industry has been pretty successful in many cases.
I think they've also taken some ownership in the vaping industry. So, you know, the two are not like Juul sometimes made it look like they were the alternate to smoking.
Yep.
But I think they're kind of getting friendlier now. So that's going on in the background, too. But anyway, Marjorie, so here's a question for you.
What?
If I said there's cannabis oil in these vaping things, and what you should do is smoke some oily substance and inhale it into your lungs, you would say?
I would say, after reading about these poor kids on oxygen in hospitals in comas, I would not get near one of those vape pipes.
And that's my view. It's
like
this thing is set up. We don't know what the dangers are. It's supposed to be better than smoking cigarettes, which give you tar and other, you know, weird chemicals. But for a lot of these things, you're smoking basically our new best friend, cannabis oil.
Right.
Heating it up. I don't know what the heck that's doing to your lungs. Nobody's ever studied that. I think the case for vaping is zero. I mean, it's like we have enough problems with tobacco. I don't see why we would be urging kids to take up vaping. And that's where the advertising went. But that's what all those flavors are all about, right? That's what
You know, this story mentions something called IQOS that heats up tobacco, this new way of smoking, or supposedly having fewer problems from smoking, that heats up tobacco, and it's kind of a version of a vape pipe, but not with the oils and stuff like that, that some are arguing is a better alternative. I've never heard of them before.
Yeah, they're new. I don't know too much about them, but I would say this. You have to pull the vaping stuff across the board the way that's happened there, because it's a real catastrophe with all these lung problems, so many hospital admissions. I don't know how many deaths. There have been a couple, I think. You got to figure out what's going on here. And I know people are saying in the background, but wait a minute, doesn't tobacco kill a zillion people every year? Why aren't we doing the same thing? Well, it's been legal for a long time, and overturning that would be tough.
I thought you were onto something. When you said you see zero reason, and by the way, I'm on the side of the governor on this, even though I feel bad for some of the small business people who are losing their opportunity. One,
Is the jury in or not on whether or not the far more serious problem is prevented or at least gotten around by vaping getting you off cigarettes? And how about medical marijuana usage? Some of that is vaping too, is it not, or am I wrong?
Yeah, well, the medical marijuana, you're smoking, I'm going to say, oils and dangerous things. That ought to get studied before that's the mode of administration. There are other ways to use your medical marijuana, by the way.
How about getting off cigarettes?
And cigarettes, I think the data is mixed. There's some people who have definitely moved from being addicted to cigarettes to being addicted just to nicotine, which is what vaping is. I guess that's a little better. But the huge numbers of young people taking up vaping who didn't smoke anything swamp whatever the benefits are of the switchover.
I think the lesson on the marijuana art is everyone has to go back to the old-fashioned rolling a joint or getting a pipe or something like that.
Growing it in your little windowsill garden there.
Exactly.
And all that. Yeah.
Exactly. So let's move on. You wanted to talk about the story about the Des Moines Register where the reporter exposed a man's racist tweets that when he was that he wrote when he was 16 years old. This young man went on this campaign to raise money, and I think he raised $100,000 and gave it to charity. And
the campaign was originally to raise money for beer, and then it expanded.
Right.
Okay.
Was that the Brent Kavanaugh campaign?
Yeah. Ooh. Okay. Carson King was the 24-year-old man who raised more than $1 million for Iowa's Children's Hospital. And Jim's right. It started out as a request for beer. Excuse me for my voice. I'm sorry. But in any case, the reporter from the Des Moines Register looked into this Carson King person, discovered these tweets from when he was 16. And then after that, turns out that the reporter himself, when he was 18, had done these really racist tweets. So they... the reporter lost his job, but the Carson King discovery caused a lot of controversy because Carson King wrote these things when he was 16. So what's your take on this?
By the way, I'm a little surprised that Jim hasn't offered you something to vape to help your throat.
I know.
Never do that to Marjorie.
Yeah, I'm drinking a lot of tea with lemon and honey.
There you go. There you go. All right, so this is driving me nuts. It's also the everyday ethic.
I knew
topic.
It would
it drives
be.
Me so crazy.
I figured it would be. Go ahead.
So here's my... proposal about youth craziness, stupid behavior, rotten tweets, racist, homophobic, sexist conversation. I am not going to talk about behavior if you do something that's different. So I was 16 and younger, and I would describe myself, at least in the 13 to 16-year-old age, as an idiot. I don't know what I said. I don't know what I tweeted. I don't know what goofball jokes I told. But I think it's time to draw a line and start to say, you know what, younger teenagers are both stupid and likely to say crazy things and likely to kind of push boundaries. I mean, that's what you do when you're a teenager, right? You talk that way. So I don't think we should hold anybody liable anymore for what they said when they were under 16. I'm not talking about if they attacked somebody or molested somebody or, you know, killed somebody or something. I'm just talking about speech because I think this has gotten out of hand. This whole idea that I found these tweets, that this guy made bad jokes when he was 14, I'll bet three quarters of those listening could be found to have made bad jokes about some group or somebody or something off color when they were 14. And it's I just think it's out of control.
But Art, I think as a general proposition, I agree with you. However, Carson King, am I right, Marjorie? He's only 20. Is he 24?
Carson King is 24.
So if
he
Carson
apologized profusely,
right, and he did because he knew the thing. Well, he knew that the story was coming out. He did a public apology before the story came out. But wait a second.
Ones. It wasn't one that if I've offended anybody, it was a.
No, I know the apology was fine. I'm not quarreling with that. If he were 44, Art, I would totally agree with you. This is only 8 years removed. So let's take him, well, not as a hypothetical. Let's assume the stupid 16-year-old who said stupid things like you did and I did and we all did is 19 years old or is 21 years old or in the case of King, 24 years old. That's not a lifetime ago. That's within a certain, you know, segment of your life that is not that far away. So that still should be off limits? Because I'm not sure. You think so?
I'm still saying off limits because I think – you know, we all understand under 16, you're trying out the world, you're pushing the limits, you have fights with your parents, you swear at your sister, you act like a complete knucklehead.
Okay.
And that's just how it is for what I'm going to call younger teenagers. If you can't vote and you can't engage in most legal activities till you're 18 and all that, then I think you got to be look, I'm not saying you can't criticize it or yell about it or so forth, but this notion that we're going to expose the fact that Art made a bad joke about an ethnic group when he was 13 and therefore when he's 24 we're going to, you know, expose him in the paper as some kind of racist clod, that just doesn't seem right to me.
Okay, so what horrible thing did you put out when you were 13, obviously?
I think I said something like, public radio is for softies.
Okay.
We're talking to Art Kaplan, medical ethicist.
Art Kaplan, I'm very upset about this next story because I guess I'm too old to be a yuppie, but I eat a lot of avocado toast because it's a wonderful thing. They have the Newsfeed Cafe. It's delicious, and I love avocados in general. So should I be concerned if I'm going to get, like, GMO'd avocados in the future because of climate change?
Or should you be concerned if you don't get GMO'd that avocados, there's a real climate change impact,
yeah,
and you're a big climate change issue. So go ahead.
So now you're really this is double whammy driving me nuts. This is hipster ethics. I don't like GMOs. I don't want any GMOs in my food. I'm going to restaurants that don't serve GMOs. I am really worried about GMOs, so I go to the organic section of my supermarket or whatever. But no avocado toast? Bring on the GMOs. Are you kidding me? You got to save avocados. We can't have no avocado toast.
It's nothing like
that's
it.
A disaster.
Really?
By the way, there are people around the world because of drought, lack of the heat out of control because of climate change and all that, who are like starving and would love to have GMO food so they could eat their basic diet. There's coffee crops that are dying, citrus crops that are dying, bananas are dying because we can't control the pests or there are other problems, and people are proposing use genetic engineering to, you know, strengthen those things before we lose all of those species. But nope, it's avocado toast that triggered the big worry.
Because Corby Kummer, who is Mr. Food to Table and Mr. Natural and Mr. Mm-hmm. Organic, he is in favor of genetically modified foods. So where are you on genetically modified foods?
I'm in favor, too, if you could save the citrus crop in Florida from different bugs or prevent bananas from being wiped out because it's a monoculture, you know, everybody eats the same banana worldwide more or less, and if something attacks it, it's gone. And if you need wheat or cassava root or something in poor countries and they can't, and it would be helpful to engineer the plants so they could grow with less water or protect themselves against more heat, yeah, tomorrow, let's go. I know it's not the best answer, and there still might be some concerns, but look, here's what the current agriculture is unless you're purely organic. You pour chemicals all over the place. Some of the residue gets in you, and the rest of it rushes down the river and kills everything in the Delta, right? That's the Mississippi.
That's a very good point.
New Orleans and all that. So it's not like current agricultural practices aren't a mess. Genetic engineering could help.
Can I tell you, this is a waste of time. The alternative is not, forget avocado toast. Do what
easy
I do as of yesterday, a pack of Hebrew Nationals. That's what you do. I mean, is that the way to go? Yeah.
I believe that's the way to go because I am certain that the preservatives in those hot dogs will keep you alive for a very, very long time. What could attack you if you had that kind of preserve?
Exactly.
So look, here's the other part of the GMO speech. The reason we got into trouble with that technique is it was owned by Monsanto.
Yeah.
They used it to make crops that were more compatible with their pesticides. That's what they used GMO for, to tolerate bigger use of pesticides. That's not green. That's not healthy. That was ridiculous. So it gave GMO a horrible name, deservedly so. Time to get past that, use the technology for green purposes or make the food healthier. That's another option. Then you could have GMO hot dogs.
Beautiful.
All right, Kaplan, I won't ask you what your everyday podcast is because you already told us it's
everyday
a revelation of
tweets.
Racist tweets or nasty tweets. Or
You know, I admit it. I'm trying to clean up my own record.
Okay.
It's true.
I think we knew that.
But nonetheless.
Okay. Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's the Drs. William F. Virginia Conley Mitty Chair.
Thanks, Art.
Director of the Division of Medical
Thank
Ethics
you.
At NYU Langone Medical Center, co-host of the Everyday Ethics Podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, Art, again. Coming up, WGBH Executive Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here for his rundown of the latest movies, arts, and culture around town. Next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 for his rundown of the latest arts and culture events in and around town is GBH's Executive Arts Editor, Jared Bowen. Jared is the host of the TV series Open Studio. You can catch that Friday nights at 8:30 right here on GBH2. Hello, Jared Bowen.
Hello.
Hello, Jared Bowen. So let's talk about the new iteration of The Joker. Joaquin Phoenix plays The Joker.
Yeah, this movie is getting a lot of conversation because it is the origin story of how the Joker came to be, and it's incredibly violent. So to really describe what this film is Joaquin Phoenix plays this young man who we come to understand has been institutionalized. He's been medicated. He lives at home with his mother, who is probably the strongest relationship that he has. And we realize that through the course of the film, that can be precarious. He is a clown.
Let me tell you, I know it can be precarious. I know it firsthand.
That's what happened to Jim.
Sorry. Okay, let's just move on, Marjorie. I said what I had to say. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
How about when you're washing your mother's hair as she's bathing in the tub? Maybe that lends itself to a precarious relationship.
And
imagine Joaquin Phoenix and Frances Conroy from 6 Feet Under. She plays the mother. But he's a clown. He loses his job. He's pursuing a stand-up career. But really, he is chief among the disenfranchised. We see how he's bullied and abused throughout his life. And then he gets a taste of what it's like to seek vengeance. He murders 3 people on a train, and that emboldens him. And he finds this conviction. And this is the reason that this film has garnered a lot of attention of late, is this concern that it might perpetuate violence. That said, it was one of the top films at the Venice Film Festival, took top honors. I thought that Joaquin Phoenix was absolutely mesmerizing here. The sallow face, he's emaciated, a very pliable face, because here he is playing the Joker. A really, really riveting but profoundly disturbing performance at the same time.
Here's a little clip from Joker. Listen up.
You know, I do stand-up comedy. You should come see a show sometime.
I could do that.
People think you're weird. They don't feel comfortable around you.
I don't want you to worry about money, Mom. Or me.
All that sacrifice, she must love you very much.
She always tells me to smile and put on a happy face.
You're so funny, aren't they?
Is it just me, or is it getting crazier out there?
Was that Robert De Niro's voice in the middle of that thing?
Yes, it was.
What does he do in this thing?
Well, it's very significant, I think, because the film visually takes us back to, you kind of get the sense from marquees you see on the Gotham theaters to about 1980, which is really about the same time frame as Taxi Driver. But here Robert De Niro plays a talk show host, and a late night talk show host that Joaquin Phoenix's character Arthur Fleck, before he becomes the Joker, is mesmerized by. He becomes the epitome of what he wants to reach because he is so funny and humorous. But we do find Gotham at this time where there's a state of emergency. The street is filling with rats and garbage. People are angry when the headlines start to swell about this clown who's killed these Wall Street types on the subway. Everybody in Gotham starts wearing clown masks. It's their way of protest. It's their way of perpetuating what he's done by echoing his expressions.
Why did he kill the Wall Street people?
Because they were bullying him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So there, if you go online, you'll see there's lots of conversations. Should this film even be in theaters given this moment, this time?
What's your take on that?
I mean, by the way, what I will answer that, and then I have a follow-up thought here.
You know, frankly, I think my position is a little colored by what happened at the screening last night. There was a press screening in downtown Boston, and at some point somebody started yelling back at the screen, and it was distracting, and one of the other patrons in the theater yelled down with some expletives. There's already one clown on screen. There doesn't need to be another one. And then I'm thinking, if somebody is yelling out at a screen in a movie theater, they might not be well themselves. So now you're echoing in this audience what we're seeing on the screen, and it was very unsettling to me.
What was the upshot? What happened?
He finally quieted down. A couple people spoke to him, and he finally quieted down.
Yikes.
Yeah.
So I thought I had read somewhere last week that there was extra security at theaters in some part of the country.
Well, because we should point out that when Keith Ledger was playing the Joker in, what's it called, Dark Knight?
Yeah. One Academy Award,
yes,
posthumously.
Yes, well, that was on the...
Oh, that was the Aurora thing, right?
Aurora,
that's right.
Colorado,
yeah, I forgot about
the
that.
The mass shooting in the movie theater in Aurora, Colorado.
Colorado.
And families there have said that Warner Brothers should be doing something to help lobby for gun reform.
And
Warner Brothers said they have done. That Warner Brothers urged the families urged the company to end any political contributions to candidates who take money from the NRA.
There's been a lot of conversation like that, and I think of late discredited threats made in relation to this film. But really, this is something that I think holds, as art often does, a mirror up to society. And here, it so deeply reflects our ugliest selves. But I will tell you, it did put me on the edge of, does this go how vivid is this mirror? Is it too vivid? Maybe this isn't the right time for it, but of course people will go and decide for themselves, because...
Don't you think this thing is going to be huge? I mean, the more there's conversation about the appropriateness, I mean, this is going to be huge. I mean,
well,
not to mention that the Joker is a pretty appealing movie subject to begin with. I would assume this thing is going to be record-breaking.
One of the things that really upsets me, and okay, I'm not big on violent movies, but whenever I go to the movies now, unless I'm at some art house seeing some little indie film, the previews are just violent.
Yeah.
And so many of these shows on television, the ones that you all like, Jim, so you're perpetuating the problem, are terrible. I mean, Game of Thrones, you know, or Breaking Bad.
I watched one Game of Thrones ever. By the way, I watched the most violent one. What's that?
The Red Wedding.
Red Wedding. That's the only
Breaking
one I saw.
Bad. Every time I turned it on, someone was getting shot in the head.
And it doesn't have to be that way. I just saw the show I'm obsessed with right now is Mindhunter. Have you seen this?
No. What is this?
Netflix. It's set in the 1980s, and it's about this psychological team who are the first to really begin to understand that they can study serial killers, although they're really the ones who invent that term, to understand how serial killers operate and how they think so they can catch other serial killers. Mm. But Mindy Kaling just tweeted out this hilarious thing that essentially I'm watching a bunch of people in gray suits talking in gray rooms, and yet it's the most terrifying thing that I've ever seen. And I thought she's so right, because nothing really violent, nothing truly scary happens on the screen. It's just the anticipation and the feeling that's conjured. So it's done really well.
Okay, let's talk about Brad Pitt's new movie, Ad Astra. Which is supposed to be all about masculine insecurities in the wake of feminism.
Well, I guess that's one take. The way I looked at it is I really, really enjoyed this film, as I did the director's last film, which was the director is James Gray. His last film was The Lost City of Z. And I remember talking to you guys about it, this exploration on the Amazon. And it just kind of flows along. Not a lot happens, but it's kind of this existential journey. And I feel like he's continuing that now, but in space. And so we find Major Roy McBride, played by Brad Pitt, who we realized right away as somebody who has just kind of gone through life. He never really gets much of a raised pulse. He's just very calm, cool, collected. That's all he's ever done. And he's assigned this mission that involves his father, played by Tommy Lee Jones, who had been on a mission years before to go to Neptune. And they find these electrical surges that are affecting the United States, and this is set in the somewhat near future. But they need Brad Pitt to go beyond the dark side of the moon to communicate with his father. Mm. But as he gets closer to this possible connection with his father, his pulse does change. He starts to have these feelings and kind of reconciling how his life has been without his dad and what it means to have his father come back in. And yes, Marjorie, I guess that's when men start to explore their masculinity or their place on not on Earth, but in space. But Brad Pitt, I think, has really come into his own.
They said he was really good in this.
I think between Once Upon a Time in Hollywood earlier this summer, for which he definitely deserves an Oscar nomination for supporting actor, and this film, he's really, really captivating because this film is largely built on him and all these tight close-up shots. And this is something you could not skate by.
How come you haven't said stunning visuals? Acting. I assume in a movie like this there have to be stunning visuals.
Stunning visuals.
Are there not?
Well, Brad Pitt is a stunning visual. Let's face it.
Yeah, he has a lot of shirtless scenes in Hollywood. And then I looked up his age. You know, he's in his mid-50s
now. Mid-50s.
You know, and I try to maintain, but I thought, am I supposed to look like that in my mid-50s? That seems
When can we give up, Chad? That's the question.
I think we have, Marjorie.
That's a really good question.
I don't think the issue is when can we. When did we?
Okay, speak for yourself, Jim.
Actually, Jim, to answer your point, it's... We've seen so many how many Spaceport movies have we seen throughout the canon? And these are really different. It's kind of a more austere aesthetic that the director has created here. I was just excited to talk about a space movie so I could maybe hear your Sandra Bullock gravity impression just one more time.
I'm not going to do an impression. It was horrible. I mean, it's just...
I want to know.
When you do Katharine Hepburn, I'll do Sandra Bullock again.
How are things with him and Angelina Jolie? Are they out of court on the custody dispute? They've got the six children.
Oh, good question.
Or are they still? We don't know.
The last time
know.
I was talking to Brad, he was telling me. No, I haven't. I don't know.
Lee Jones the guy? Was he Al Gore's roommate?
Yeah,
was that the guy?
At Harvard,
was, okay,
yeah.
Al Gore's roommate.
You know, I heard an interview with Brad Pitt on our station, WGBH. Oh. It was late at night. It was terrific.
With whom? Okay, good.
It was a national...
Maybe David Remnick. Was it Remnick?
NPR.
Was it New York?
No, it was
New
not.
Yorker
it was a woman.
Oh.
And he was really fun to listen to. Mm. And she asked him about the custody battle and Angelina Jolie.
Oh, and he was forthcoming about that?
Well, he did not go into detail, but he just said it had obviously been a very difficult, trying time in his life for him and his family.
Can I make a suggestion? If people would like to hear me do my Sandra Bullock, if you email Jared at our show, bpr@wgbh.org, and say... If Jared does, will you do it if Jared does Katharine Hepburn? My answer will be yes. And if we're flooded with this, I think we can get there. So that's bpr@wgbh.org.
So let's move to shows now. Tell us about, this sounds like a great production of Andrew Lloyd Webber's Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah, this is, first of all, I'm realizing that a lot of people don't know the film. Do you both know the film?
Yes.
Yeah, thankfully. Yeah. Because I thought it was fairly iconic.
But tell the story for people who don't.
So
older
this is the story
star.
of Norma Desmond, who's holed up in her castle, kind of mansion-y castle on Sunset Boulevard. As is suggested to her, she was a big star once, although she answers, I am big. It's the pictures that got small because
yeah,
this takes
place.
That's
a great line.
Exactly. Gloria Swanson delivering
that's what
that
I said to a fan just last week, actually. Came up to me and said, I remember you. But God, I'm sorry.
And who is the male actor that played? And that was it William Powell?
In the movie?
We'll have to look
I don't know. We'll go continue. Sorry.
But his character in the film and in this musical is Joe Gillis, who's a screenwriter, not quite finding success, and so he's kind of
William Holden,
and so he's not quite finding success. The studios have rejected him, and he gives chase trying to hold on to his car as the repo agents are coming, and he hides it in Norma Desmond's decaying mansion and comes across her. And so this musical really it's well timed, actually, because it's in some ways it's the story of Judy Garland.
I was just gonna say it sounds exactly like it. Yeah,
this woman who gave her all to Hollywood and then has been, of course, she's a character, Norma Desmond, and then has been just shunted off to the side. But in her mind and in her home, she still looms very large. As one lyric says, she's never known the meaning of surrender. But she sees this young light in this young man, so she moves into her home, into the room of husbands, as her butler describes it. And this musical tracks how she pulls him into her orbit, and he can't quite resist. So this is at North Shore Music Theater through
October
6th. That's
still a theater in the round, by the way.
It is, although it is a little bit more proscenium staging in this version because they had to take up so much of the stage with her mansion and the big staircase that she has to descend. But there are two phenomenal stars here, most notably Alice Ripley, who is a Tony winner for Next to Normal.
Say, yeah, right.
Amazing voice, really terrific performance. And Nicholas Rodriguez plays Joe Gillis. And the two, I find, have this great, great chemistry as there is this push and pull for power.
Didn't I read that she was in the play as a kid? Playing a different part? Is that right?
So part of the conflict with Norma Desmond is Joe becomes besotted by this young writer who's part of the studio system. And in the Broadway production that starred Glenn Close, for which she won the Tony,
right.
Alice Ripley played this young writer.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so
that's
she's a had nice a long connection. History with the show.
So this thing sounds spectacular to me. The thing with Passengers. Tell us what this is. This is only here for a few more days. I looked it up. Is that right? Through October 6th?
Through October 13th.
13th,
that's
great.
That's what I have in my notes.
Okay, good.
So this, and people might remember, actually, when I was filling in for you over the summer, Marjorie and I had two of the performers.
Oh, I heard. Yes, oh, I didn't know, though. I heard you on the radio. I heard you on the radio.
They were
great.
They were in spectacular condition, too.
Yeah, it was great to understand from that interview how they do things and then see them on stage actually doing it. But this is the Seven Fingers, a notable Montreal-based circus troupe. They kick off the 10th anniversary season of Arts Emerson, a season in which because it's their anniversary, they're going back to some of the productions that have been tried and true, and then groups like this that have been a main part of their seasons over the years. So this is actually the U.S. premiere of Passengers. It's all about journeys. And as we learned from that interview, these are performers who come together and they really use their stories. And a lot of them, have learned, to come from around the world to do these circus acts in Montreal. So they bring their stories. They bring their stories of journeying and moving and leaving families behind. And as I always am so fortunate to say, for as much as I've seen circus acts or Cirque du Soleil, there still seems to be so much that's new. You have a woman who's a hula hoop master who seems to like hoover up the hula hoops from the floor. You just watch her body and think, how did she do that? A man who makes juggling one ball riveting for how he does it underneath his shirt. You have not a pole dancer, but a pole entrancer, this man who's moving up and down the pole sideways. Just the physics of that are nearly incomprehensible to me. A contortionist who moves both herself in every which way and also the fellow passengers on a train. It's not such a narrative arc, but it does return to this theme of journeys and the sounds and visuals of trains over the 90 minutes of this show.
Do you remember a couple of weeks ago, unfortunately it was on radio, so people don't get to see it, you, Marjorie, and I did a Russian Cradle, I believe it's called. It was remarkable. I was really strenuous, and I was exhausted for days. Well, but that's how it ends. What is the Russian Cradle? That's the final thing, from what I understand. They're on a platform. You're giving me a blank stare kind of thing.
Well,
it's like the
remember.
Final part of the play where, whatever, okay, Russian Cradle.
They do have this unbelievable picture of the man coming down on the trapeze, and he's upside down holding onto the ropes with his knees,
mm-hmm.
and holding by the ankle the female performer, and she's suspended, I don't know, at least 6 or 7 feet above the ground. I mean, that's what's incredible. It's like when you see Cirque du Soleil. I mean, they are...
It's unbelievable. You can't believe this is real, that they're human beings.
You can't believe that these bodies can do what they do. It's amazing.
And the great thing about seeing it in venues like the Majestic Theater is that you are so
close
to the stage, so you can almost see how little much finger room there is when they're gripping one another in the circumstance you just described, Marjorie, with the aerialist or the trapeze performer hanging over one another. Also, we talked to the wire walker, who is a wire dancer on this circumstance.
A wire dancer.
He's dancing on this
imagine?
Tiny little wire.
Yeah. No,
so here's
incredible.
What Russian Cradle is.
They went to circus school as children, too, remember?
Yes, yep.
So a Russian Cradle, one acrobat is a base connected to a platform. That's the part that I played. Meanwhile, the other swings underneath the platform, then launches into the air before being caught again by their partner. Takes a lot of whatever. It began with the flyer unexpectedly diving headfirst off the platform, only to be caught by his ankles, and then on it goes, and that's the end of the thing. By the way, it's so weird. There's certain things that I love that I don't sort of fit who I think I am. This kind of thing in the Cirque du Soleil, I am just I've never, ever had a bad experience. They're just incredible. And it sounds like these people are really talented, too. I can't wait to see it.
It really is, yeah.
Yeah, I just looked up Sunset Boulevard, the movie, and you see a million pictures of William Holden with no shirt on.
Oh, really?
That seemed to be a recurring theme. Gloria Swanson is, got her hands all over him, and he's recoiling.
What year was that? Does it say what year that was?
1950.
No? Was it 1950?
I looked it up right before I came down,
Okay, let's go to the MFA and this Women Take the Floor.
This is excellent. I just saw this got national attention in the New York Times as well. So we know the Art of the Americas, major wing at the Museum of Fine Arts. The third floor has long been dedicated to modern art of the last century. And here they have completely, with I think maybe one or two exceptions, have turned over their third floor, seven galleries to all art of women from the 20th century, predominantly working in America in the 20th century. This is an extraordinary effort that has been underway because there has been so much more conversation, finally, over the last couple of years, that the 20th century art and art today is not defined by Ben. It wasn't just de Kooning and Rothko and Jackson Pollock who were defining what art in America was, but there were women who were creating. And so the MFA has created a whole spate of stories. The core of it is women depicting women. You see artists like Frida Kahlo, Alice Neal, Cindy Sherman, women looking at other women in their portrayals. There you'll also find a video by Portia Olaiwola, the poet laureate of Boston. Very, very compelling. I had her on Open Studio recently. You have art and design in the 20s and 30s, including pieces by Mita Warwick Fuller, who we just talked about recently from the Danforth Museum, a woman working right here in Framingham, Massachusetts, who was at the forefront of sculpture, an African American woman was. That's why she was so limited in what she was able to do publicly. We see them working through fiber as sculpture. And then probably one of my favorite galleries is Women of Action. And you have five artists who are documented in this book, Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel. It is one of the best books I have read in the last couple of years. So I'll repeat the name of the book and the author's name one more time because everybody should read this. Ninth Street Women by Mary Gabriel. And you find Joan Mitchell, Grace Hartigan, Helen Frankenthaler, Elaine de Kooning, and Lee Krasner.
I didn't even know there was an Elaine de Kooning or a Ms. Frankenthaler. I think I mispronounced it. But, I mean, did you? I didn't.
Well, I did. And this is the problem, is that there was always the story.
We slapped you down there, Marcia. That comeback guy.
Well, that's not what I meant. Okay. The problem writ large is that everybody thinks that these, just the men created.
Exactly.
Well, all of these men, there was a very, very tight circle in New York where Elaine de Kooning was married to Willem de Kooning, Helen Frankenthaler, ultimately to Motherwell, and Lee Krasner to Jackson Pollock. They were all creating together. And by the way, when they started creating together, it was a time in which it wasn't acceptable for men to be artists. So this is why they could all work together. But then critics started to pay attention, but they only paid attention to the men because the prevailing wisdom was only men could create something that could be groundbreaking. Obviously, that was not the case because they were all human beings creating together and really changing what art in America and the world over meant. And you have these five major figures all assembled in one room, giant paintings. It's mesmerizing.
So I got an email from a guy by the name of John this morning who said, stop talking about David Byrne. The show has left town. And because he said to stop talking about it, I'm going to talk about it. And not only am I going to talk about it, but there's a useful reason. I didn't realize it was opening in New York. It's opening Friday night, I think, or it's opening really soon in New York City. The only reason I bring it up again, beyond the fact that I was totally mesmerized, it's one of the few things that all three of us have seen. We talk about a lot of stuff. Usually one or two of the three of us has seen what you're talking about. All three of us got to see this. Meredith was here yesterday. Meredith Goldstein
fantastic.
Was here. She loved it. It is. I mean, you can go to New York because, I mean, you got to go buy tickets. As early as this Friday, it's there for, I think, 4 months or some such thing at the Hudson Theater. You reviewed it before we had seen it. I mean, tell people again how, I mean, it was spectacular. It wasn't unlike almost anything I've seen.
Well, yeah, just to remind people, essentially what David Byrne did is he took his music, both as an independent artist and for the Talking Heads, and figured out a way with a really talented team, director, choreographer, to show that music in a really stripped-down way but make it so evocative. You know what else I've been thinking of? We see these ridiculous, overwrought spectacles like the Super Bowl halftime show or some of these major stars who fill stadiums, and they feel that the only way they can be compelling
is
if they just throw money at the lights and the costumes and the smokes and the pyrotechnics. Here, David Byrne did something that, as people have told me, this isn't even me saying it, although I do feel it's true for myself, that this they will remember this forever. And he did it by stripping everything down and just finding its essence.
They're not even in mic stands on the stage. They're in gray suits. Everybody's in a gray suit and they're barefoot and they just have their instruments and they're on, they're performing. And I thought the silver mesh that they had all around the stage so people could go in and out was absolutely brilliant. I also want to say, as long as we're talking about things, you had a great show with the Windsor Homer at the beach and also the Julian Fowles interview. And of course, he's the person behind Downton Abbey. The new movie came out.
It beat Ed Astra, by the way, at the box office.
Yeah. Yeah, blew everything away. So what's on Open Studio this week?
We will take you to another phenomenon, Love is Calling, which is the Yayoi Kusama Infinity Room, now on view at the Institute of Contemporary Art.
I've got to go see that.
Exactly.
You've got to go see it.
And it's good timing because the next batch of tickets is about to go on sale to members, ICA members, and then to the general public. You do have to get tickets to enter this, but we'll take you inside it, and we'll tell you the rest of Kusama's story as well.
Can you take care of Marjorie or no?
Marjorie can take care.
Why
of
are you lost for words?
We'll
either can or you can't.
And then we have a conversation with Liev Ullmann, the great.
No.
Yes.
Oh.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Jim.
Talking about her career, her acting, how raw she gets, her partnership with Ingmar Bergman, and then her work with refugees.
That is fabulous.
You're about to get married, don't see scenes from a marriage. Or don't see the other one. What's the other one with the glass and the cutting?
Oh, the broken glass, the shard.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, you don't want to see
Hearts
that one either. Whatever it was.
Cries and Whispers.
Cries and Whispers, thank you.
Oh,
it's really an upbeat film.
Okay.
Take care of Margaret with the tickets.
Jared Bowman joins us every week. He's the host of the TV series Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights. Up next, Joe Kennedy versus Ed Markey. We're going to talk about that on WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Gaines. When Joe Kennedy jumped into the Senate race, he tweeted, "This is the fight of our lives, the fight of my generation, and I am all in." But is it problematic that Ed Markey's policies and positions seem to align with Kennedy's generation, millennials? Can Kennedy, a descendant of an American political dynasty, effectively brand himself as an insurgent candidate like Ayanna Pressley, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, to unseat a long-term incumbent, or do Markey's progressive credentials make that a harder narrative for Kennedy to follow? Join us to talk about this race and how the generation Kennedy is fighting for might vote, or Stephanie Murray and Miles Howard. Miles is a freelance writer who covers culture, travel, and transformational politics. I'd like to see some of those. He is the author of The Early Voters, Millennials in Their Own Words on the Eve of a New America. Stephanie is the author of the iPolitico Massachusetts Playbook. Miles and Stephanie, great to see you both. How are you?
Great. Thanks for having me.
Again. Pleasure.
Good to be here.
Thank you very much for coming in. I apologize again for my voice. You know, let's start with you, Miles, since you wrote the book on millennial voting. Before we get to Joe Kennedy and Ed Markey, I know that the turnout was significantly up in 2018 among millennials. Do we think? What's the we don't know yet, obviously, but what's the sense of how significant millennial voting is going to be in 2020?
I think it's going to be a continually upward swing for millennial voters right here. I mean, one of the central ideas that was depressing millennial turnout prior to 2018 was this idea that politicians were, you know, detached from the concerns of ordinary people, especially young people, that they were loyal to their donors and to the rich mostly. And what we saw in 2018 was a lot of millennial insurgents from very humble backgrounds finding the audacity and the grassroots support to challenge incumbents, quite often from the left, on the idea that those incumbents were not working for ordinary people anymore. That's what fueled campaigns from politicians like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley, and it's going to continue next year.
But can I just stay on this for a second? The celebration of 31% drives me out of my mind. 31% is abysmal. It is pathetic. And if we voted 31% across the board, we'd dissolve the democracy. So is there a notion that while 31% might have been a high watermark, Stephanie, that a higher watermark is in the offing for 2020 with arguably Donald Trump? We don't know if he'll be there, but Donald Trump versus whomever the Democrats put up?
I mean, it's definitely a turbulent time in politics right now, especially among Democrats. But the thing to remember here, if we're talking about the Senate race, is that the Senate primary between Joe Kennedy and Ed Markey isn't going to happen in November or on Super Tuesday. It's going to be in September.
That's a
good
point.
The challenge for them is to jack up turnout when Donald Trump is not specifically on the ballot. And from what I've seen so far, that's what Joe Kennedy's trying to do. I mean, he's been visiting immigrant groups. He visited a homeless shelter, people touched by the opioid crisis. He's kind of trying to turn out and engage people who don't normally vote at high levels. So it seems like that's the play that he's trying to make.
And we should say, for the record, that Liz Reardon and Pemberton are also still in this race. They were in before Kennedy, and as of the moment, it's a four-person field.
So let's talk about millennials and this race. You got the Sunrise Movement, the Sierra Club, you know, a lot of environmental groups, because Ed Markey, back since I guess, 1980, when he first tried to get legislation through about climate change issues. Where are the millennials on this race? It is obviously a 38-year-old. He's not a millennial, but he's close, Joe Kennedy, versus a 73-year-old Ed Markey.
Well, I think a mistake that a lot of people make when they look at how millennial voters make decisions is assuming that they just want younger people in office right there. That is certainly a key part of what millennials want. Millennials are underrepresented in Congress, but it's ideas and policies that really drive them to the polls right there. That's why we saw a lot of millennials come out in support of Bernie Sanders in the 2016 primary. It's partly why he holds a very large slice of the youth electorate right now. And I think that with Markey and Kennedy, you're actually going to see more millennials rally around Markey at this point because he is the co-author of the Green New Deal, which is the most transformative piece of climate change legislation in American history. And it would also transform the economy in many ways. And Joe Kennedy, while a millennial himself, has been somewhat more lukewarm in terms of supporting transformational policies like Green New Deal. He hasn't really been a leader like Markey has in actually going out on a limb and working with these new millennial politicians like AOC to actually, you know, make these things happen. So I think that you're going to see I think Kennedy's going to struggle for actually getting the majority of his own generation on board with this campaign here.
Well, and by the way, the other argument obviously is two words, Bernie Sanders, obviously. Bernie Sanders is about 100 years old. And
right.
As we said earlier in the show, obviously he's got a health issue, which obviously we wish him well, but he did very well. But you know, with all due respect, Miles, to your analysis of this thing, I spoke to David Palaiologos this morning from Suffolk, who did the poll in which in a four-person race, Kennedy had a 9 or 10-point lead, and a head-to-head, he was up 14. Mm. I asked him for the breakdown of the millennial votes. He went took it up to 18 to 35. It's 5-1 Kennedy in one of the matchups, 3-1 Kennedy in the other. And while you might say it's because they're, you know, they don't know a lot about his record yet, I might say it's because Markey's been there for 40 years and they don't know anything about Markey's record. That's a problem to try to say you haven't followed what I've done, or I haven't conveyed it well for 4 decades, and now I'm going to convey it in 12 months.
Absolutely. Well, that's the trick that Markey has to pull off here, along with his supporters, is demonstrating that record as loudly as possible for people who are very familiar with the name Kennedy and may have been kind of asleep at the wheel and what Markey has been trying to accomplish on an environmental front for most of his time in office. And I think that most of that support is going to come from grassroots organizations like Sunrise Movement and other climate orgs that are already rallying around him right now. And I think you know, his reelection is going to depend solely upon that, I think, for the most part.
We're talking to Miles Howard, author of The Early Voters, Millennials in Their Own Words on the Eve of America, and Stephanie Murray, the author of Politico, Massachusetts Playbook. You know, Stephanie, you write for Politico, you cover politics. I mean, one of the things I think is a problem for Markey, and I've said this before, is there are certain politicians that come along. Deval Patrick was one of them here in Massachusetts. Everybody thought he was a total joke. He came out of nowhere. He wasn't in the whole Democratic playbook. First black governor. But you went to a Deval Patrick rally and people were crying and they were beside themselves. And I think he's a better speaker than Barack Obama ever was. Joe Kennedy is not in that category. But when you look at political talent and charisma, which is matters as much as issues to a lot of people, I've seen Markey speak a lot. That's not his forte, and Joe Kennedy has gotten better. I mean, that's a problem for Markey, it would seem to me.
I mean, that's the challenge for both of them. I think Markey's got to kind of reintroduce himself to the voters after 40 years in Congress. His name recognition is pretty low, so he has to kind of fire people up, and Joe Kennedy has to do the same thing. Like, we all know the Kennedy name, but it's going to be his job over the next 12 months to kind of fill in the form and show people what kind of Kennedy and who he actually is. I'm not sure who's the better speaker between them, but we've got a long way to go.
But saying, should it not be held against – if you're in Congress – by the way, I admire a huge amount of what Ed Markey has done. It should be clear. I've followed him, as Marjorie has, for a long, long time. If you represented a jurisdiction for 4 decades and you now have to introduce yourself and what you've done to the voters during that 4 decades, should that not be held against you? I want to know from the people who represent me exactly what they're doing minute by minute in real time that affects my life. I mean, that is not something that accrues to his benefit, is it there, Miles?
Not particularly. And I think that one of the biggest criticisms against Markey that kind of sticks is the idea that he's been somewhat absent from the area as a senator over the years. He doesn't spend enough time in his district. And, you know, we rarely see him here around here. And I think that that's one of the strengths of being primaried is being reminded, hey, you actually have to keep up with this sort of thing if you want to remain in good standing with your constituents and have them appreciate the work that you may be doing on a legislative front, because a lot of people don't pay attention to this stuff on a granular level day by day. And I think that having a more present congressman or senator right here helps keep people, you know, rooted to what's going on in Washington in their name.
You know, Stephanie, there are two kinds of endorsements. I'm not convinced that endorsements matter anyway. Some days I think they do. Some days I think they don't. An endorsement that might matter is Ocasio-Cortez, because I think in many ways, while obviously they were co-sponsors of the Green New Deal, she and Markey, for a lot of people, it's counterintuitive. You know, insurgent campaign, how Joe Kennedy's going to try to paint himself. But the flip side is that Markey is supported by the whole establishment. And we had Karen Spilka, the Senate president, on the other day, and we asked her, you know, she and the House Speaker said they were sticking with their endorsement. And one of us asked Senate President Spilka, well, if you had not endorsed before Kennedy got into the race, who would you have endorsed? And there was a long pause before she said, well, it's a hypothetical, and I don't know. Assuming that much of the establishment in the Massachusetts political infrastructure sticks with Markey, most of whom endorsed them before there was a Kennedy candidacy, does that hurt or help a candidate in an era when incumbency is not seen wildly well by a lot of people?
Well, that's the question. But a lot of the dynamics in this race have been kind of flipped on their head. So Markey's got the backing of pretty much the entire state delegation, a lot of lawmakers in the state house, but he's still running.
Including Elizabeth Warren, we should say.
Yes, that's true.
Who was the person who introduced Elizabeth, I mean, and Joe Kennedy.
Joe Kennedy introduced her.
Kickoff.
Yeah, so endorsed her.
Right. Even though he's got all this support, I mean, he's polling so far behind Kennedy that he's kind of running an insurgent campaign. He's been needling Kennedy to face him in a climate debate in November.
Has Kennedy responded to that, by the way, yet?
They are meeting today, I think, in a couple of hours to hash out the debate schedule.
Really? Yep, and so the other two, Liz Reardon and Pemberton, said yes.
Like their campaign aides. It's not the actual candidates. But so he's done that. He's kind of released a video on YouTube that was really critical of Kennedy's corporate PAC record. Mm. So even though he's kind of got so much establishment support, he's running as an insurgent.
But one of the things you've heard the Democratic establishment talk about is money, and that this is going to take away a lot of money away from donors that could be spending their money elsewhere and defeating Donald Trump. What's the angle on that, Miles?
Well, I think the concern here is that when it comes to Democratic campaigns, there's often not as deep of a money reservoir to dip into when it comes to, you know, getting support from donors compared to candidates running on more conservative issues who may be able to curry favor with wealthy donors more easily. So, you know, Kennedy running against Markey is going to divert money away from other campaigns that could flip red seats, that could flip, you know, more conservative seats in general. And, you know, and also there's the fact that Kennedy's seat itself is going to be highly contested now between, I think there's like five candidates in the race at this point. It'll probably double within a week. But, you know, it's a reflection of the obscene cost of running campaigns, of course. But, I mean, that is something that I see a lot of anger from younger voters about right now.
Can we go back to the first question so that my head doesn't pop off? You know, we don't really see the disengaged millennial. The millennials who call our show, the 28-year-old who calls our show, is engaged by definition, or he or she wouldn't be calling in with an opinion. What is the reason for 69% of otherwise eligible millennials in 2018 deciding that it doesn't matter, I have more important things to do? You've studied these voters. What's going on?
They really think it has no effect on their day-to-day lives for the most part, because they are used to decades of politicians ultimately running on, you know, promising sounding ideas at certain points, but ultimately, whether it's in the service of bipartisanship or just convenience to their donors, you know, capitulating on big policies that might actually make life a little bit easier for millennials who've
been struggling. So if you're a political consultant, and what advice would you give if you were a candidate? Don't tell me follow through on your promises. I mean, the theory is, what would you say to a Kennedy, a Markey, anybody running for any office who felt that if I can, you know, the millennials broke, I think, 2-1 Democratic. So let's say the Democrats in particular should want them to come out in 2018, what would your advice to a Democratic candidate be to
move it above 31% in 2020?
I would say do a thorough check and see if what you're talking about in the trail is actually in line with what you've done as a politician or a professional in any field prior to that. That's one of the great strengths of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, is that their policies, their rhetoric actually matches up with what they've done while in office here and there. And that, and trust is a key issue with millennial voters right there. So that's, and I think that's one of the great obstacles Joe Kennedy is going to face, is that he's kind of embracing this new generation of leadership rhetoric that politicians like AOC and Presley have been realizing quite recently, but his voting record does not really hold up to that in some ways.
What advice, I know you're not about to give advice either, but what advice would you give a candidate, Stephanie, to jump above 31?
I mean, my sense is that voters really, especially millennial voters, want somebody who they feel is like quote-unquote authentic. It's what a lot of people like about Congresswoman Ayanna Presley. Like, she'll hop on Twitter and you can tell that it's not her staff writing the tweets. It's people like AOC, because she goes on Instagram Live and just answers questions without poll testing what she should say first. And it's what people liked in Texas about Beto O'Rourke when he was running for Senate. I mean, he would hop on like a Facebook live stream in the car with Joe Kennedy and just talk about whatever was on his mind. So I think it's kind of that less calculated stuff and just kind of speaking from your mind.
Can I stay on Presley for a moment? I think it's fair to say that Ocasio-Cortez was an insurgent who beat an old school, both in terms of policy and everything else, Crowley. I did the only debate in the Presley-Capuano thing, so I actually studied both of their records. Ayanna Presley may disagree with this, but I think it is fair to say he was a very progressive congressman with a very progressive record. What she offered, I believe the word she used in the debate, is bold leadership. Bold leadership, that's, but it's not a tangible. It's in, I'm not discrediting it, but it wasn't exactly, she was young and new and an African-American running against an older white guy. It seems to me the generational thing and bringing out voters who hadn't voted before was what caused her to crush him. Is that not a fair post-analysis?
I think that's a fair analysis. After, and I think that a key difference, though, with Kennedy Markey and Presley Capuano is that when you look at the representation for women of color in Congress, there is an enormous deficit that's been there for a long time. When you look at representation for young white men with deep family wealth, that's not exactly a pressing problem right now. And so,
fine point.
So even if Kennedy and Markey were on the same page policy-wise, you know, he wouldn't be able to, you know, get ahead with the Presley logic right here. In some ways, there's not a strong case.
You know, there was another issue, I think, in the excuse me, in the Trump Hillary Clinton race.
We only have a minute, by the way.
That they were the two most unpopular people ever to run for office. So, in some ways, it was tough, I think, for a lot of people to get themselves to the polls in that race. And we all predicted in the media that Hillary's going to win. I'm asking you a question over there.
I mean, I think it's, if you're just looking at the polls right now showing Kennedy ahead, I think it's foolish to think that that's exactly what's going to happen next year. They've got a long way to go. Miles, I don't know if you agree with that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what we're going to see in the interim right here is whether or not the efforts of the establishment, quote unquote, and climate activist groups can actually propel Markey at this point. It's going to be a big lift, but I think we've got a long time. It could very well happen.
Well, we had Bill McKibben on. We don't have time to play the clip, but the co-founder of the environmental group, what is it called?
350.org.
Who said this was a gut punch, the announcement that Joe Kennedy was going to run because of Ed Markey's long record.
By the way, and he volunteered that. We didn't ask him a question about it. McKibben offered that position.
He said he was dealing with a lot of devastated young people. Anyway, thank you very much.
Great to see you both. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Author of the Political Massachusetts Playbook. Miles Howard is a freelance writer who covers culture, travel, and transformational politics, and the author of The Early Voters, Millennials in Their Own Words on the Eve of a New America. Thank you both very much for coming in, and thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow we're going to have Andrew Gabroff, another edition of Law and Order, Paul Revel on education issues, Harvard Business School historian Nancy Kane. I want to thank our
How about Chris Cooper and Marianne Leone are here tomorrow about their new film.
Oscar winner Chris Cooper.
And Marianne Leone, brilliant writer, actress.
Play in the Sopranos,
Christopher's mother.
Okay, I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeley, Aiden Kami, our engineer, John McClure Parker, what is on television tomorrow?
Well, surprise, surprise. We're going to do the latest on impeachment, and believe me, there's going to be a lot new between now and 7 o'clock tonight. We're going to talk about the Harvard admissions decision yesterday and what it means for affirmative action and admissions going forward. Derek Jackson, who most of you know from his Boston Globe days, has become a leader in an effort to preserve and expand the puffin population in the face of climate change. He is doing brilliant work, brilliant photography. He'll join me, and I'm going to do a little commentary on justice a year after for Jamal Khashoggi.
Sounds spectacular, Jim.
I think it's going to be quite good.
I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and have a great afternoon.